So good morning, everyone. We are going to call the meeting of the TRPA Governing Board to order. The date is Wednesday, October 26th, and it is 11:33. So with that, the first item on the agenda is the roll call. Mario, will you call the roll?
Ms. Alding?
Here.
Mrs. Sagaski? I will circle back.
I'm here. Thank Sorry.
You. Ms. Conrad Seda?
Here.
Ms. Diss?
Here.
Ms. Faustinos?
Here.
Mr. Friedrich?
Here.
Ms. Gustafson?
Here.
Mr. Hicks?
Here.
Ms. Hill?
Here.
Mr. Honigman?
Here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
Ms. Novosel?
Here.
Mr. Rice?
Here.
Ms. Williamson?
Here.
Mr. Yates?
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to go through our rules for the day for members of the public who are joining us remotely. To observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov. Under the calendar heading, click on Governing Board Hybrid Meeting for October 26, 2022. There you will find a link to the public webinar hosted on Zoom. To address board members directly with your comments, raise your hand in Zoom by clicking Raise Hand at the bottom of your screen at the appropriate agenda item. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the board. If you have used the dial-in numbers to join us by telephone, you can dial *9 to raise your hand and be unmuted. To remote board members, if you wish to speak, please also raise your hand in Zoom. You will find the hand icon on the bottom of your screen. Remote board members may not use the chat box to make any comments or to have sidebar conversations. Please, everyone, remember to mute your mic unless speaking to cut down on background noise. And finally, I would also like to ask that all remote members turn on their cameras if they are able. Members of the public who have joined us in person, please raise your hand at the appropriate time for public comment and you will be called to the front to speak. And board members who are here in person, please raise your hand if you wish to comment and speak clearly into the microphone in front of you. If you are viewing the webinar on a personal computer, please ensure that your microphone and speakers are turned off to prevent audio feedback into the room. So now we'll go to the Pledge of Allegiance. And Alexis, will you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Alexis, and all. So we will now move on to the approval of the agenda. Are there any staff changes to the agenda today?
No, Madam Chair, no changes.
Thank you. Are there any objections from the board? Otherwise, we will deem the agenda approved. Anyone online? Okay, thank you very much. We'll deem that agenda is approved. Now we'll move on to item 4 on our agenda, approval of minutes. We do not have any minutes to approve this month. The September 28th Governing Board meeting minutes will be included in the November 16th packet. Then we would move on to item 5, our TRPA consent calendar. There are 3 items on consent, 2 of which were reviewed by the Operations and Governance Committee and 1 which wasn't reviewed by any committee. As a reminder to the public, after board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in person to be called on in Zoom or to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So first off, Shelley, may we have a report from the Operations and Governance Committee discussion on the September financials and inflation adjustment to the TRPA application filing fee schedule.
The Operations and Governance Committee reviewed the September financials, and as reported last month, fees for service remain high, exceeding prior years. This includes planning fees, AIS fees, and shoreline fees. In addition, all expenditures are within budget, and based on this, the Operations and Governance Committee recommends approval of the September financials. Should I move on to calendar consent calendar number 2? which deals with the amended application filing fee schedule. As you might remember, the governing board adopted policy allowing for the annual adjustment of the filing fee schedule based on CPI increases, or 3%, whichever is greater. According to staff, the present level of filing fees doesn't cover the cost of the planning division. As a result, in order to account for inflation, the Operations and Governance Committee recommends that effective January 23rd, 2023, filing fees be raised by 8.3%, which is only slightly higher than the 8% adjustment approved in the 2023 fiscal year budget. These recommended adjustments will not affect the waiver of application fees for affordable housing projects that use bonus units, nor will they impact AIS or mooring registration fees that were addressed in previous board actions. In addition, the committee also recommends the approval of some non-substantive clarifying changes to the schedule as outlined in the board packet. In addition, as a result of discussion at today's meeting, it was recommended that as part of our process improvement process going forward, we consider exempting daycare centers as we have certain affordable housing projects due to the critical shortage of daycare services. And with that, that's my report.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from board members on those two items? I'm not seeing any, and I'm not seeing any on. So with that,
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a comment with respect to item three.
I was just going to item three.
Okay.
So item three was not heard by any committee, and this is the multiple use pier. Slootman Tan new multiple parcel multiple use pier 2050, 2140, and 2200 North Lake Boulevard, Tahoe City, Placer County APNs 94, 140, 032, 033, and 034. TRPA file number ERSP 2022-0041. And this is on page 71 of our packet. So are there any questions?
Is Tiffany on the line? Or is
Tiffany's online. I can also.
Yes, I'm also here, Shelley.
Okay. Tiffany, did you? You and I exchanged emails. Did you want to just note some of what I think are valid corrections to the permit?
Yes. The on page 84, the third paragraph should read the three parcels instead of the two parcels. And then page 85 under special condition two as well, the conditional reflect the two mooring buoys that will be exchanged for boat lifts instead of the one under special condition two. And then on page 86, special condition 3I, again, just reflecting that there will be two buoy tags that will be removed for the conversion. Thank you.
I guess I have a question. There'll be three tags, right? Because three buoys are being replaced with boat lifts.
Yes, I'm sorry. That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Yes. John.
Madam Chair. Question on the public access item. I see that California State Lands approved public access underneath the pier. Oftentimes these piers are loaded with no trespassing signs, giving the impression that the area is off limits to the public in the public trust area below high water. Any clarification, will that be made clear in signage or otherwise that is still public access through there and no misleading signs placed?
Yes, that's correct. And per our code, that does relate to public access. No trespassing signs would be prohibited.
We certainly have a lot of them
yeah.
around the lake below in the public trust area that I'd like to address in the future.
Right. Well, they're often posted on the pier, meaning the public can't go on their pier.
Right.
But
and often they're posted at the high water mark, giving the impression that you can't go anywhere in that area when you
right.
can't.
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions? And online, do we have any comments or questions from our board members? Not seeing any. So now we'll go to public comment on this item. If any member of the public wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now, either in person or by clicking the raise hand button at the bottom of your Zoom screen, or by dialing *9 on your phone, and you will be called on and unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Are there any members here in the audience who would like to speak on this item? I'm not seeing any. Tracy or Maria, are there any online?
Madam Chair, there are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, so we'll close the public comment period, and I'll ask for a motion on our consent calendar.
Madam Chair, I move to approve three items on consent.
Thank you, Shelley. We have a motion. If there's no further discussion, Maria, would you call the roll?
Ms. Alding?
Yes.
Ms. Conrad Seda?
Yes.
Mrs. Sagaski?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos?
Yes.
Ms. Diss?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Madam Chair, the motion passes.
Thank you. We'll move on now to item 6 on our agenda, the appeal. This is the appeal of the Tahoe Transportation District, Washoe County School District Temporary Use, TRPA, file number pound ERS, P2021-0673, Southwood, 771 Southwood Boulevard and 915 Northwood Boulevard, Incline Village, Washoe County, Nevada, assessor's parcel numbers 132-201-02 and 132-012-05, TRPA file number admin 2022-0027. Information on this item can be found on page 261. And again, as a reminder to the public, after the staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in person to be called on or in Zoom webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So I'm going to now pass it to our chair of our legal committee, Haley Williamson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a very good discussion in the legal committee on this issue this morning. A few points I'd like to put in front of you all. First of all, the committee decided that it did want to hear the appeal, that it could hear the appeal. And so at I know 11.6, Rule 11.6 was raised as a standing issue, but the committee decided that it did in fact have standing. There was sufficient harm, there was sufficient contact with the issue, and so we heard it on its merits. We had a very good discussion that I would like to say centered on the balance between the importance of transportation and also the concerns raised by the appellants and from Incline Village. Ultimately, what the committee decided was to recommend to the full board that we deny the appeal, and the reason why is because the appeal is for the permit that was issued in May for last season, so something that has already passed. And instead of just granting the extension to the permit, we have a list of conditions that we want to see brought back to the board in order to grant the permit going forward. That list of conditions included better signage, better training for people working at the parking, better enforcement of parking, working with local law enforcement on the parking issues, public participation, working with state parks on information regarding parking, working with trying to get better barriers so that people aren't parking on South Coverage, and having staff and TTD work with the public and having public participation in this process as before it comes back to the board. So really long list of conditions. I can go over those again, but that I think to encompass what the legal committee talked about this morning was not issuing this permit going forward until we saw these things come back to us. We recognized it was a pilot program. That's the point of a pilot program, is to make improvements. But we heard a lot of input, really good input from the community as well as from TTD about the importance, but finding that balance.
I realize I say this all the time in my other job. I talk fast. I talk a lot. So happy to answer any questions. And committee members, if I missed anything, please let me know.
Yes, Ashley. Thank you. That was super helpful. I think actually it'd be great, given the number of public comments that we have, that we just really clearly lay out. This was a firmer permit. If you wouldn't mind just laying that out again, because we did get so much public comment, that would be great. And then itemize the conditions just one more time.
Yep, thank absolutely. You. So again, we're denying the appeal because it was for a season that passed. It was issued in May and the season is closed now. That parking, from my understanding, that parking lot is not open for the season. And so going forward though, before we would issue any extension or allow that permit to be continued, we want to see this brought back before the full board with a series of conditions incorporated into that permit. Those conditions include better signage when the lot is full or when there's overflow, better training for people that are working at the lot, better enforcement of parking issues, which includes, because we don't have control of someone else's enforcement, but us making sure that the local law enforcement knows that parking is high on our list and asking them if there are ways we can partner to make sure that happens. More and better public participation, better barriers so that people aren't parking on soft coverage, and coordinating with Nevada State Parks on the correct information for parking there in writing so people know. Oh, and you know what? I did miss one. The gates of that area, we were seeing pictures of backup traffic flow, so opening the gates to the parking area earlier so that we're not seeing as much backup traffic. And this list, I should say, is a list that staff also took a lot of really good notes on. But those are what I have in my notes, and please, someone correct me if I have missed something.
Yes, Mr. Friedrich.
Madam Chair, was there a discussion? I came into the tail end, but a discussion of monitoring of those conditions with consequences, such as if those conditions are not satisfied, and by whose definition, I guess, will they have consequences for further extension of the permit?
Yes, we talked about that a little bit in terms of training, I think, for enforcement so that and signage, so that there's better signage at the front end and that we're dealing with a problem, I think, before it gets a problem. So people aren't parking on soft coverage, so they're parking where they're supposed to. And then that part of that as well was talking to local law enforcement to make sure that they and us know that this is a priority and to see what they can do to help better enforce some of these things. And
right.
Sorry.
And I would just follow up to say, well, maybe this will come out in discussion. I know we're going to have the hear more from everyone, but I'd be interested just as we're thinking about that, just kind of understand how will we evaluate whether those conditions are being met, who's evaluating them, what are the indicators of success? Is the community involved in helping to define these conditions? And then if those conditions are, like, say there's not enforcement, people are just parking as they have all over the place, and despite these conditions, nothing is happening. Awesome. Will there be consequences based on proven monitoring of those conditions?
So two things on that point, because it's a good one. One is that this permit, it's still a pilot program, so I think we hope to change it and to reflect what we're hearing back. This permit can be extended for year, 2 years, or no years. And so we have control over that at the board. There's clauses in the permit that allow us to extend that permit or not. So we can have it back in front of us if we want to see this every year to see what progress we're making. And then that permit is pretty malleable in terms of conditions we want to add or subtract. So all things that they're great questions that I think we have control over.
Can I just clarify just
please
a couple things? One is that the permit is only for another one more season.
That's right. So this one is one season.
Yeah. Just another season. So then they'd have to come back for a permanent application and permit. There is a, just also, John, to your point, there is a complaint section of the permit that allows complaints to be filed with TTD. I think Bridget is here if you want to hear more on that, or we can wait till we get into more discussion.
I would suggest we wait, because I think there's many of us who weren't involved already and have such questions. So that was a good report from legal committee. And unless there's questions, anything else from legal committee, then I would call on John if you want to provide staff presentation.
Staff is fully supportive of the motion and result of the recommendation of the legal committee. So we will not have a staff presentation unless you want to hear on specific issues on the appeal.
Okay. So then we'll move to the, yes. Okay, sorry. And I'm reading, it's hard to see hands. So we're going to move to the appellants. And following the discussion earlier at legal committee in which I was in the room, there were a couple of the appellants that weren't heard under the public comment. I'm going to urge the appellants to include all discussion in their discussion now so that we can continue to follow the protocol that the agency uses in dealing with appeals. And so, Rhonda, I'm going to ask that you give your presentation, and if you want to defer any time to the other appellants in that, I would certainly entertain it at that time versus coming back under public comment. I hope that's clear to those of you who participated earlier. We do want to hear all ideas from the appellants on the issues at one time. And so with that, Rhonda, I'm going to turn it over to you, and you can give your presentation.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I am Rhonda Tyser of Incline Village, and I am making these comments on behalf of 25 Incline Village appellants to the governing board. I'm grateful to the legal committee for allowing us standing. We are requesting that the governing board reverse the temporary use permit for the TTD's East Shore Express. I will refer from now on to the East Shore Express as ESE and to the old Incline Elementary School as the OES. I will address the specific issues mentioned by TRPA in the staff report. I refer my responses to sections of that report. Section B1, the evidence supports special use findings. The first finding is the ESE transit station is an appropriate use for the surrounding area. We disagree. The staff rebuttal only addressed the type of use allowed in the zone and does not address the equally important nature, scale, and intensity of use. In fact, the majority of input from Incline residents over the years has been evidence that the nature, scale, and intensity of the ESE is damaging and dangerous to the surrounding low-income neighborhood and to the Incline community at large. Catherine, would you please start the slideshow? The OES is the worst possible place for the ESE transit hub, with constant traffic on a tortured road. The two-lane road is not big enough to handle ESE traffic. Every ESE bus and tourist car heading to the OES parking lot goes through the stoplight at the Highway 28 intersection with Southwood. As buses and cars turn through from Highway 28 onto Southwood, they go down a steeply curved two-lane road that in a few hundred feet leads past the OES to the Village Center and the U.S. Post Office. Most Incline residents pick up mail on a daily basis because Incline doesn't have home delivery. So hundreds of residents must go through that same stoplight and down Southwood past the OES every day. The ESE causes traffic jams on both Southwood and Highway 28. The ESE entrance to the OES parking lot is just a few hundred feet. So during peak periods, as tourist cars go through this intersection before they can enter the OES, they pull to the right to wait along the curb. When cars are backed up all the way from the OES entry to Highway 28, there is massive spillover, so cars heading east on 28 cannot get through the light to turn right to go down Southwood. I have personally sat through three changes of the light trying to turn right. The ESE transit station is not an appropriate use for the surrounding area. Even if the type of use is correct, the quote, nature, scale, and intensity of use, unquote, at this site is wrong. These problems will not be changed by signage, training of workers, enforcement barriers, opening gates, or any other TTD band-aids. The access road is wrong and can't be changed. The low-income neighborhood can't be changed. TTD needs to explore other Washoe County sites for its pilot program for the ESE. We are fully in support of a pilot program and future incline mobility hub in a different locale. Section B2, the ESE transit station will not be detrimental to surrounding property. Staff members contend the ESE at the OES does not include physical changes to the proposed location and conclude that it will therefore not be injurious or disturbing to the health, safety, enjoyment of property, or general welfare of the persons or properties in the neighborhood. We disagree. Just because there are no physical changes to the property as yet does not mean that there are no negative impacts on incline residents' health, safety, or general welfare. Nearby residents have provided numerous examples over the years, most recently appellant Aaron Vanderpool. His 87-page formal complaint to TRPA and TTD documents major negative impacts to him and others in the neighborhood. In his complaint, he references increased crime, trespassing, illegal use of HOA and business property, public endangerment due to speeding, illegal backing up into traffic, illegal U-turns, pedestrians nearly hit by cars, a cyclist nearly hit, danger of swerving around cars along the curb waiting to enter the lot, trash, noise, pollution, and against TRPA regulations, parking on dirt. We believe these evidence-based complaints prove TRPA staff is wrong in saying that there are no injurious or disturbing effects of the ESE at the OES. Further, staff members contend that the vehicle miles traveled analysis was a sufficient traffic study by which to conclude the ESE causes no increased traffic impacts. They studied only traffic impacts on vehicle miles traveled and traffic volume. In fact, the ESE natively impacts traffic, neighbors, and nearby HOA and business property parking. People hurrying to make the bus park wherever they find space, loading and unloading recreational equipment and children illegally as convenient, making illegal U-turns on a two-way street, and so on, will not stop. Appellant Vanderpool's photos show numerous traffic and parking problems. These negative traffic effects in his formal complaint will be multiplied 100-fold should the ESE continue to operate from an expanded OES bus station. Staff's dismissal of our documented traffic concerns and complaints was simply wrong. Finally, Section D. Staff concluded there was no need to coordinate with the FTA or NDOT because there was no NEPA or categorical exclusion protective property acquisition action or process with which to coordinate. We disagree. Because the 771 Southwood property was purchased using FTA federal funds via an application for funding in connection with a NEPA or CEQA by the Nevada Department of Transportation on behalf of the TTD, the primacy for regulatory environmental review considerations rests with the FTA under NEPA. Therefore, per TRPA Code of Procedures, Chapter 6.2, TRPA should have coordinated its environmental review of the change in use of the property. We continue to go on record that TRPA staff misrepresented TTD's past use of the OES for the ESE. The staff report says that the service has been operating for a number of years on a less informalized basis. That statement is an obfuscation, vague and incomplete, since the past use of the property was that of a 10-year inactive elementary school campus with 8 years of illegal non-permitted TTD ESE parking and a non-permitted TTD bus transit stop. Less formalized in this case means unpermitted, and unpermitted means illegal. We contend that TRPA's granting of the temporary use permit represented a change in use and was in fact an intensification of use of the parcel. The original MDOT TTD federal funding application stated, quote, for the last 9 years, TTD has been using the property for a seasonal transportation hub, unquote, when actually the past use of the property was that of a 10-year inactive school campus with 8 years of non-permitted TTD parking and a non-permitted bus transit stop. We contend that there was a change in use, and that change was from illegal to legal, which staff can't deny. In summation, we Incline residents know from years of experience that the ESE service from the OES has had an overall negative impact on our village core. For this reason, we are united against the TTD operating the ESE parking and transit service at the OES in the future. We are not against a mobility hub in Incline. We are open to considering an ESE hub in a different site. We have in the past suggested sites. We are simply against the ESE operating from this particular site. We also know that the TTD and TRPA use the, quote, tyranny of small decisions, unquote, to advance their objectives. This temporary use permit approval is just one small decision, following many other small decisions, with more to come. To date, TRPA has not completed a comprehensive environmental study of the cumulative impacts of this temporary use permit on Incline Village. We contend TTD is wrong to operate the ESE at the OES, and TRPA staff was wrong to approve the use permit allowing TTD to do so. We stand firmly on our entire appeal and ask you to do what's right. Reverse the TRPA staff's temporary permit decision. Thank you on behalf of all appellants and citizens of Incline Village.
And thank you, Rhonda. Did you hear my earlier comments that if there were other appellants issues that needed to be raised, that you do so? Or that they you cede time to them? We've expired the time, but I'm willing to extend it to make sure those appellants are heard right now.
I would like to do that, please.
Okay, so we'll give you 3 extra minutes to take the appellant's, the other appellant's comments. Okay. Maria, can you see if are there others online that testified earlier, I believe? Doug and Mr. Flaherty and Mr. Vanderpool, I think.
Mr. Flaherty does have his hand raised at the moment.
Okay.
And I don't see any other hands raised at this time.
Okay. So, Mr. Flaherty, I would ask that you conclude with 3 minutes of any other comments.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much for extending the time. We really appreciate it. I'll try to be brief. First of all, I also want to thank Ms. Aldean, I think, for mentioning that all of the East Shore Express visitors, that they want to be transported by bus, that should be out of the basin and not in the middle of Incline Village where we dump 3,100 cars during the busy season. I think there's been enough evidence to show that it really does warrant additional community input on this. I think we need to bring this back to the baseline of the community itself and have a community meeting to discuss this civilly, and also to modify the permit, and this is me speaking specifically as me, not as an appellant, but to modify the permit to terminate the second year because of the overwhelming evidence that this is unsafe to the community. There's been various items recommended by the legal committee to help with that, but I think it needs to go back to a hearing officer process. This is the only way that we can assure our committee that you guys are really listening to us. Other than that, I guess I'll stop there. Again, we really appreciate your sensitivity towards allowing us to speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty. And one more chance for Mr. Vanderpool, if you would like to address the board. please raise your hand.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vanderpool is no longer online.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that. So now we will pass it to Tahoe Transportation District. Bridget, are we passing it to you? I'm not sure who is presenting for TTD. Is George still on the line?
George.
Okay.
He's on the line.
Thank you. And George, yes. You also have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. George Fink with Tahoe Transportation District. I'm the Transit System Program Manager. Give a little background on the East Shore Express. That was established as part of a systematic approach to addressing chronic congestion in the SR-28 corridor and as part of a larger regional transportation plan. This incline is not an and or with this with this idea of whether there should be external intercept lots or internal intercept lots. The planning that has been done to date shows a need for both. But there does need to be an internal transit system to support any of the external intercept lots. And that's why this is being built out in the way that it is and why you have other mobility hubs around the basin, such as the one in Tahoe City, the one at LTCC, and now the idea of a possibility of one being located in Incline Village. So the East Shore Express began as a pilot program out of the original SR-28 corridor management plan in 2012. And it operates each season from early June through Labor Day. And that went on for 8 years, from 2012 to 2019, in partnership with Nevada State Parks. In 2020 and 2021, the service was suspended due to the pandemic. And then this year, the service returned. And although it was a shorter season, so only 72 versus the normal 77 operating days, and we only ran one bus rather than the two buses from prior seasons, yet we still carried 29,000 people, which is about 79% of what was carried in 2019. As was referenced, we intercepted about 31, almost 3,200 cars throughout the season, parked at both the old elementary school and the existing Incline Elementary School at 915 Northwood, which is the overflow lot mentioned in the permit. There was some discussion earlier about how we handled complaints. TTD has an extensive complaint system that's required by the FTA in order that we log everything that comes in as a complaint. We record that, we address it, and keep a record of that. So that was, as part of the permit application, that was forwarded over to TRPA at the beginning of the season. That's what we have done throughout the season. We had 7 recorded comments, 6 during the season, with 1 coming after the close of the season, and then another one coming in after that a couple of days ago, which was Mr. Vanderpool's. So of the 6 comments received during the season, 1 was a compliment and 4 were operational concerns. One of those operational concerns was an issue with an East Shore Express returning to the yard in South Lake Tahoe. So really, when you look at that, it's interesting that most of these complaints weren't vocalized, I guess, to TTD, and so we're a little bit off guard on that. But we certainly want to engage the community as we go along. And we agree with the recommendation from the legal committee, and the conditions, I think, are all good business practices going forward, that we should continue to improve the program as we move into next season. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And Tara Frank, also with TTD, is in the audience, and she can also assist with any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Are there any questions? Should I go on to the rebuttal first, or do you have any clarifications you want me to ask? I'm trying to follow the cheat sheet, but also my common sense.
You can do whichever you like.
Okay, well, we will see if the appellant has any other rebuttals to the staff presentation. And did Bridget want to weigh in at all on this one? Okay. Rhonda, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Yes, I will simply repeat what I said before, which is In the 2022 season, the East Shore Express captured 3,188 cars. Those cars drove into the basin. They drove miles to get to the old elementary school. They then parked. And then they got on a bus, which went 7 miles to Sand Harbor and 7 miles back. This is not going to reduce vehicle miles traveled in the lake. We understand that this is supposed to be a link around the lake, and we look forward to being part of that link. We are simply objecting to this place for a transit hub. I continue to remind everyone, we are not naysayers, we are not NIMBYs. We are looking for a solution that will really work for both TTD and for the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhonda, appreciate that. Okay, so with that, board members, I wanna see if you have any questions or comments, but I first would like to go to Commissioner Hill, who represents this area and has been very involved in this issue since before taking office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say I agree with the legal committee's recommendation. I think that the additional conditions are things that, as chair of TTD, I can work to deliver. And then as a commissioner for Washoe County, I can work with the sheriff's office and see what we can do. I will just make a note for the record on the parking. And I think this was stated during the legal committee, but I was driving, so it was cutting in and out. Many of the people who are parking on Southwood, they are the backbone of our community. They are the workers of our community. We have multiple families living in these apartment complexes. We just simply don't have the parking for them. That's something that Washoe County understands, and we are actively looking to see how we can support them and find places for them to park. And also this bigger question of workforce housing is something that we're tackling as well to really ensure that we're taking care of people. I just want to make it clear that I don't believe in necessarily ticketing folks who are parking on the right of way who are our workers in our community. So that's the only thing that I think we need to kind of work through on who the people are who are parking on the right of way. But I think the legal committee did a really great job of assessing the community's concerns. And part of the way that I think that we can get community input is our mobility hub committee meets every month. We just met this Monday. And I think it'd be fine if we have this as a standing item, especially during the season, so folks can give us their concerns. And it's certainly something that we can ensure that we have these public meetings that the community is asking for. So thank you very much for the consideration. And I think this is a really important pilot program. And we're working with RTC and Reno to see how we can ensure that we have fewer cars going into the basin, but that's not going to be addressed with this permit today, but it is something that we're working on. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexis. I know you've been very engaged with your community up there on all of these transportation and parking issues. So other comments or questions from board members? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is odd for me. I've never sat in 8 years. I've never sat on this side of the room. It's very weird. A little disoriented.
But you're on the right side now.
This is really just you want to comment. You know, I've heard about, and I really appreciate the work that Commissioner Hill's done. I'm a South Reno resident. I do know that there's a lot of folks from Reno that do go up to Sand Harbor. I do want to remind folks, Sand Harbor is one of our state parks. Not everybody that goes to Sand Harbor is coming up from Reno. I mean, they're coming from all around the lake and from all locations. So having a Reno to Sand Harbor connection, we've had them in the past. I think it's helpful, but it is not a solution for having to move people around. And it's not the final solution to the Highway 28. My question is really, and I heard a little bit of the legal committee, but mine is a kind of a clarification. I'm reading the permit conditions that's in the packet. And there's many conditions about a temporary signage plan that needs to be approved prior to permit acknowledgement. There's a lot of conditions in here about how is CTD going to handle complaints. So was the thought from the legal committee that these conditions, well, one, I guess, has TTD already submitted the signage plan and it's acknowledged, or is this to beef up the condition before the permit is acknowledged or the temporary signage plan is approved? Maybe it's because I'm on the wrong side. A different side of the room. I don't know, but I'm trying to figure out exactly what the process was.
I'll go ahead and address that if that's appropriate. Bridget Cornell, and I'm a planner with the Permitting and Compliance Department. The permit was already acknowledged for the current, for the 2022 service year. So the project was approved at hearings officer in May. We acknowledged the permit with the Tahoe Transportation District in some, you know, over a period of time in June, and they did begin operations, I believe, either the end of June or beginning of July. So to answer that question, it was acknowledged for this year. My understanding is that the additional conditions that were outlined at the legal committee are conditions that will be incorporated into a revised permit that will be brought back to the governing board before we agreed to the to extend the service into the second year. And again, just to clarify for the entire board, when TRPA issues a permit on a temporary basis, that permit is good for 1 6-month period with an option to extend for a second 6-month period. When the temporary uses that are permitted are seasonal in nature, we allow that second extension to be for the second service year. So in this case, the initial approval was for the operation of the transit service for the summer of 2022. If it is agreed to that the permit will be extended for an additional season, it would be for the summer of 2023. Again, the feedback from the legal committee this morning was to incorporate, and again, somewhere between 6 and 9 additional conditions. I promise to get them exact before we revise the permit, but it would be to add some additional special conditions to the permit, and that revised permit would be brought back to the full board before we agreed to the to extend the approval for the second service season.
I would just add to that, and Jim, it could be an expansion of an existing permit, so we would, or special conditions, so we would be looking like on the signage one to maybe have the plan in hand rather than make it conditional to include things like message boards ahead of time. So you'll be able to see that, you know, signage plan in advance, not as a condition of approval that would come through staff.
Thanks. So I appreciate the clarification. So that's really helpful because I was getting thrown off. I saw the permit authorized, but the acknowledgement page didn't have the signature on it. So it sounds like it's been acknowledged already. So, I mean, that's great. So looking through the conditions, the one thing that did strike me regarding the temporary sign plan is it said it should include all temporary signage to be placed on site. But what I was hearing is that there needs to be some more off-site signage to get people around. So hopefully that would be part of it. Thank you.
Yeah, and that was one of the conditions that was verbalized for an added condition to be incorporated. Thank you. Shelley, you had a question?
Well, and I'm assuming, Bridget, obviously the standard conditions here with respect to granting the 6-month extension is strictly, I mean, it's optional by the permittee. They have to advise you that they're interested in extending, but the TRPA has the right to either agree to the extension or decline the extension, right, pursuant to this provision in the permit.
Yes.
Right. So we maintain, and that is largely based on whether or not the applicant is applying with all of the requirements of the permit.
Okay.
All right.
But from the direction, I think that the legal committee was recommending that the board give to staff would be that the board was going to make that call as to whether to extend the period, the permit amended conditions. So we would bring that back to you. And then you all would make the decision whether to extend the permit for the second operating season.
Right, but are you incorporating that additional provision into the permit itself, John? I mean, it's a general reference to TRPA, which could include the board or staff.
No, I don't think we need to
okay.
to change that. But you'll see is amended conditions on the substantive issues, that were discussed at the legal committee.
How many, we have two people, Steve Sweet and then another code enforcement person?
We have three.
Three. Oh, goodness gracious. Yes. Okay, we're swelling the ranks.
By 30%, 33%.
And I hate to increase their burden, but I think that, you know, given the concern that's been expressed during these meetings, I think we need to be maybe a little bit more vigilant in terms of visiting the site on a more consistent basis to make sure that the applicant is complying with all of the new requirements.
Thank you. Other comments, questions? Yes, Mr. Friedrich.
I've heard the community say they wanted a community meeting. I'm envisioning that the mobility hub process could be one such avenue to say, here's our proposed amended conditions. Is that a fair assumption? And then get feedback on that, and that feedback could be brought back to the board when we decide on the permit.
And I think it's fine if we bring Bridget's staff report with the amended conditions to the Mobility Hub Committee. That's already an agendized committee meeting. We've been meeting for nearly 6 months now. So I think the community knows about it, and we'll make sure that we do additional outreach, and maybe TTD and TRPA can help us with that. But yes, that would be the plan.
And I just a second point. I know the I'm sure many alternatives have been explored. I know they have. And if by chance, say, one emerges somehow that hasn't emerged before, would there still be a chance to change locations for the next year in this process? Or do you think that's too soon? I'm presuming now we get community feedback on this, then we decide yes or no on the permit with that community input. But if the community were to come up with an alternate location, that could still be considered at any time? Or
I cannot answer a operational question like that. Bridget,
sure. Yeah, again, Bridget Cornell. When TRPA issues a project-related permit, it is generally tied to parcels. And in this case, it's this permit and or this project and this permit is tied to the two affected parcels, the old elementary school site as well as the current elementary school site. So if a new location is discovered and is considered and proposed for consideration, that would require a whole new application. We could not alter the location as a part of that's already a part of the current temporary use approval.
Correct. But can I chime in here? Sure. I think on behalf of those of us who serve on both Tahoe Transportation District and TRPA, we believe strongly that if the community has a good solution, we want to consider all options. And I think Tahoe Transportation District staff has been very involved in this discussion and in trying to find and looked at suggestions that the community has already raised for the mobility hub permit site. And so we'll continue to do that. I think those of us in local office understand we're trying to work with the communities to improve our environment here, but address the problems that we do have. So.
And the final question, maybe this is for TTD staff, but I heard Mr. Fink talk about the complaint process. I raised this early in the meeting about what is the monitoring protocol and the consequences for lack of meeting the permit conditions. If enforcement's not happening, if the sheriffs just don't have, like, you know, as was stated in previous public comment, don't have the resources to deal with this, or it's just not happening and things are going on as noted before, despite the conditions, how might a complaint process lead to intervention in these cases, and how might, you know, what is the protocol for actually enforcing the conditions as that we'll be considering in the future?
George Fink may would be more appropriate to respond to these service related complaints that have been received. But if the TRP permit is being violated, so if the conditions of the permit are not being met, then that does put it on the agency and our inspectors to follow up accordingly. I mean, you know, under extreme or I guess the worst case, if conditions were flat out not being met, we could retract the approval, or it would be considered a violation. You know, our normal inspection process would lead to an inspector going on site, reporting on any conditions, you know,
giving direction on what needs to be done to address those concerns. And then ultimately we could issue a stop work order. So that is, I mean, that's our normal TRP process. We do have it written into this permit that just a complaint process as well. And it looks like I see George's hand raised. So hopefully he's ready to address this as well. But just as an example, we did receive some comments early on in the current, in the 2022 service season, and we forwarded those comments to the Tahoe Transportation District and the operator, and they did make some immediate changes. For example, there was a backup occurring on Southwood Boulevard because the gate was not being opened until very close to the start of the service. So the TTD had an immediate fix to that, and they did start opening the gate earlier. So we do really appreciate the comments because in some cases, you know, it will lead to immediate improvement. So, it, you know, certain things are enumerated in the permit and George can address how the service concerns are addressed.
Yes. George, do you want to go ahead and address this as well?
Sure. Thank you. I think that anytime that there's a concern that's brought up, whether it's from the public or TRPA, you know, this is an operation and we're used to pivoting on the fly there. So if something needs to happen, we can absolutely make that happen. You know, it just needs to be something that we're aware of. And we certainly work with the public and work with TRPA to find something that would work and remedy that situation. You know, I think that Bridget brings up an excellent example of the traffic backing up, because initially when we started the service, we had the driver that was bringing the first bus up would be opening those gates. And we saw a different behavior pattern emerging this year than we did from prior years, of where people were trying to arrive early. And then that, you know, as some of the photos that Ms. Tyser showed in her presentation, you know, they would back up on Southwood there until the gates were open. So we moved that to be able to open the gates first thing in the morning. That's something that as an Incline resident, I did myself. So those were open about 7:30 in the morning, and then, you know, start the workday there. So it's something that we can always work with anybody that comes up with, you know, something that we need to do or do differently. I think the common goal is that we want to have a good service. We want to be a good partner and a good neighbor in the community.
Thank you, George. Other comments or questions from board members? Anybody online? Then I take the opportunity to make my comments. And this is more in a broader reminder to all of us. When we have 12 to 15 million visitors coming to Tahoe every year, parking and traffic impacts are epidemic throughout our region. And every one of us faces that, right? I live on a street near a public beach that has been discovered. And it is not the way it used to be for me to be able to walk my dogs down and be at the beach and not worry about cars on both sides. And, you know, my husband has become a regular caller to CHP on the weekends, trying to get them out to ticket because they are encroaching into the roadway in this situation because the road is very narrow. And I share that just because I think in local government, we are... those of us who live here and are working on these issues constantly, we see that we're not able. I mean, more and more people are coming to the Tahoe Basin, and some are within the basin. I do think many people who visit Sand Harbor are coming from the West Shore or coming from the North Shore. It is a beautiful, beautiful beach with a lot of amenities that people want to travel to. So it isn't all just running from Washoe County to this state park. And similarly, Emerald Bay. Or similarly, any of our facilities. So I think as part of a broader picture, it is going to take hard work with our communities and with the users of these systems to really make an impact on these issues. And our enforcement agencies are traditionally held by other electeds in county government and have priorities as well. That's why the Tahoe Fund, I serve on that board. We have been looking at how we look at enforcement. Jim is as well. How we look at enforcement on a broader regional basis, because if we rely on law enforcement, they have many other competing interests. So can we look at code enforcement
or some other officers that can take time. So I just want to assure everybody that I think, and to the public as well, we understand this is a big change, especially since I would say in the last 10 years, but certainly in the pandemic, we saw and with climate change, I don't see any way around it. Where is there going to be water accessible to our populations in Northern Nevada and Northern California? And what's going to be reliable? They are going to come recreate in the mountains. So it's just from, you know, when we're dealing with one, you know, service issue, I just remind us to go back to that big picture and be diligent. And I made a note to myself, we really need to have this workshop with our governing board on the challenges in enforcement and what we can and can't do. Because I do think even TTD, here they are a permittee, but they are also a partner in solving this. And we are your partners serving on both boards. So how can we make sure we're hearing the public, but be realistic in enforcement and direct people to the right channels for that enforcement? It may be NHP. My phone seems to be on a regular speed dial to CHP, just to remind them that this is important in a community, and it includes emergency egress and access when people block the roads. But they're doing that because we don't have an overall system that's working to deal with the crowds we have coming. So I agree with what the legal committee did. If I sound passionate about this, I've been working on transportation for 40 years of my life in Tahoe, and I, on peak weekends, I don't get to go to the post office when I want to either. I have to plan my schedule around farmers markets and ski traffic, and, you know, but the rest of the year, I live in paradise, and I've got to remember that too and say, you know, I don't own this lake. I get to share in dealing with that. So thanks for listening to my impassioned plea that we as a board look at the broader issue too and how we partner together to solve it. So and with that, I think we've concluded. I don't see any other lights on or hands up, and so I would go to now look into the public for any public comment. We have already taken the appellants, so are there other members of the public that would like to address this issue?
Madam Chair, online we just have appellant Aaron Vanderpool with his hand raised. Otherwise, there are no other hands raised.
Did he rejoin the meeting then?
He did, yes.
Okay. So, Aaron, because I was allowing the appellants to do their comments all at one time and you had left the meeting, I'm going to go ahead and extend it for you to be able to address the board now. But in the future, our TRPA processes are that the appellant should all speak during the appellant period. So, but I understand Zoom technology and issues. So let's extend this now for him to be able to speak. Yes, for 3 minutes.
Thank you. Yeah, it was, some issues. So thank you for allowing me to speak. Am I being able to be heard right now?
You are. Thank you.
All right. I wanted to point out just one thing. I keep hearing about the gates being opened earlier after a complaint, but I wanted to just point out that my photos were from the end of the season in August and September at the very end, and the gates were still not being open till like 9:30, and there were just cars everywhere. I also wanted to just say that overall that, you know, we built that sidewalk out to Sand Harbor, and you know, and we're trying to prevent all these parking issues on 28, but, you know, that actually increased the ability or like a demand for people to come here. So it increased people coming to Lake Tahoe. It increased problems. And then, you know, I've lived in Incline 40 years. I've lived at my current place for about 16, 20. I don't remember exactly. This is a more holistic issue with my neighborhood. That is just, this is on top of everything else. So you're trying to solve these parking issues elsewhere, but it disproportionately is moving the problems into a low-income neighborhood that has high-density housing. So sure, tourism and parking is an issue for everybody, but this particular site in question is disproportionately affecting the lower income and affordable housing. And this is my last affordable place to live here. I've lived all over Incline, and this is like my last spot. And I already mentioned earlier about the police issues that I've encountered on enforcement. They just don't have the resources. I wanted to follow up and add a little bit more to that, that I have invited them to attend these TRPA meetings to tell you directly that they don't have the resources for my neighborhood. And I would invite people to come out to my neighborhood. I would give them a rundown of the overall issue, because like another thing I want to mention is disproportionately affecting us is I've mentioned this before, they rock line ditches along all the wealthy neighborhoods in Incline to prevent parking next to these mansions, but they increase parking in my neighborhood, and it is needed because there's a lot of people here, but it also affects noise, and then we have more tourism parking here. And so this is a more holistic issue. And my main point is it disproportionately is affecting my neighborhood here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other public comments on this item? Not seeing any in the room.
Madam Chair, there are no other hands raised on mine to comment on this item.
Okay, so with that, we'll close the public comment and we'll open this up for any further board deliberation or questions. Not seeing any, so is there a motion? Yes, John.
The motion is on page 127. And so the motion, we need an affirmative motion to grant the appeal, which should be, if you want to deny the appeal, you need to vote no on that motion. But I would suggest that the maker of the motion say that a motion to grant the appeal, but which should fail based on the condition as outlined and recommended by the legal committee.
Do I have that motion?
So I would move that we, hang on, it's backwards. So I would move that we grant the appeal. But if people want to follow the recommend, I would also move that we follow the recommendation of the legal committee. And so if you, in this motion, should it be two motions? I know, I don't know how to do a yes and a no.
I think we would say that, if I can make an attempt at a motion, but a motion to grant the appeal, which motion should fail to affirm the hearing officer's decision, but with the conditions, one, that the permit not be extended until it's brought back to the governing board for approval, and two, that the conditions outlined by Ms. Williamson during a report from the legal committee be amended or added to the existing permit to address the concerns she articulated.
So moved.
Okay.
All right.
So then we can vote to deny the appeal, but then to amend the motions?
No, that was one motion. So it's okay. Basically incorporating the fact that to extend the appeal, extend the permit, it has to come back to you to do that.
Okay, is everyone clear? Okay, so we have a motion, and I would ask for Maria to call the vote.
Ms. Alding?
No.
Ms. Conrad-Seda?
No.
Mrs. Sagaski?
No. Excuse me, no.
Ms. Faustinos?
No.
Ms. Diss?
No.
Mr. Friedrich?
No.
Ms. Hill?
No.
Mr. Honigman?
No.
Mr. Lawrence?
No.
Ms. Novosel?
No.
Mr. Rice?
No.
Mr. Yates?
No.
Ms. Williamson?
No.
Ms. Gustafson?
No.
Madam Chair, the motion fails.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you everyone for participation. And Rhonda, Doug, and Aaron, we appreciate your public comments and look forward to seeing you at the Mobility Hub public meeting, as you heard. With that, we're going to take our lunch break now. And do we have an estimate of time to come back?
We recommend you reconvene at 1:15.
Thank you very much. So we'll reconvene at 1:15 for those of you online. Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a little past 1:15. It's now almost 1:25. So I'm going to get the board meeting reconvened here. So as you know, at break, we had just finished up on item 6. We are now moving to item 7, our planning matters. I'm hearing the feedback. There we go. So that brings us to agenda item 7A, briefing on climate resilience strategic initiative. Information on this item can be found on page 229. And as a reminder to the public, after the staff presentation and board discussion, you may raise your hand in person or to be called on in the Zoom webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So John, I'm passing this to you now, and then you will
introduce it. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Chair. As you recall from your retreat in May, you asked that we spend more time getting your input up front on the initiatives and let you know more about what's going on. So this month, we're going to be talking about our climate resilience initiative, which is actually highlighted in our work plan more than any other initiative. So it's, even though we didn't bring it to you first, it's very important. And actually, both of these items, A and B, relate to it. So what you'll get from Devin is a status report on where we are. And there are a couple areas where we're going to be asking for your priorities. So they're going to be doing some exercises on the boards here. And that's so we can get your ideas on priorities before we get into it more. And then the second item is an item that's actually carried over from work. Some of you may remember when we did the shoreline plan, before we did that plan, we actually pulled out and wrote a piece of code for public safety facilities for each county and the city to identify sites for those public safety facilities. And one of the thoughts behind that was with more extreme drought and more extreme floods, we need to have facilities that will get to deep water when the lake is lower. So we took the initiative working with the fire districts and the sheriff's offices and the police department in South Lake Tahoe and public land managers to actually convene a series of workshops with them to jointly identify sites that they thought would be good in each jurisdiction. And so Jacob Stock will be doing agenda item 7B, which is kind of a follow-up on the climate resilience initiative. So we put these both together for you. So with that, I will turn it over to Devin Middlebrook to talk about the initiative and where we are and start the exercise.
Thank you for the introduction, John. Devin Middlebrook, Sustainability Program Manager for the record. Today, as we have in the last several board meetings, you'll be receiving an update on our strategic initiatives as part of the overall work program. Today's is a briefing on the Climate Resilience Strategic Initiative. As a reminder, TRPA has long been a leader in addressing climate change. In 2014, we created our Sustainability Action Plan, which set a goal of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions in the region 15% by 2020, which we actually met in 2018, 49% by 2035, and in line with both California and Nevada, a net zero goal by 2045. We aren't the only ones that are in the climate planning business. As you can see on this graphic, a number of state, federal, and local jurisdictions all have their own climate plans. And as we know, in the Tahoe region, collaboration gets things done far better than going our own way. So while all of these individual plans are very important for local jurisdictions and states to implement their climate priorities, it's also important to bring these all together into a cohesive strategy across the region. And that's just what we did with our partners this year. And included in the packet, and I have some hard copies here if anyone's interested after the presentation. In March, we released through the Environmental Improvement Program and Tahoe Interagency Executive Steering Committee, or TIE Steering Committee, we released the Tahoe Climate Resilience Action Strategy that covers the latest priorities for climate action in the Tahoe Basin and aligned partners around priority projects to address some of those climate impacts you see there from landslides, wildfire, and the ongoing drought. As everything we do at Tahoe, we're taking an integrated approach to building climate resilience. We obviously have the lake and the importance of the lake and Lake Clarity and the habitat that provides for our fish and fauna in the lake, but also recreation access. Our forested uplands, as we all know, and talk about pretty much every board meeting, the importance of forest health in protecting our communities. And then, of course, at that core is the communities, the folks that live here, visit, recreate, and the underlying infrastructure such as roads, power, and fire hydrants that are needed to ensure resilience towards climate impacts such as Caldor Fire. Within this action strategy, there are 5 focus areas. The first is to build sustainable recreation and transportation systems, something that you were talking about earlier today in terms of recreation access and ensuring that that can be had in all seasons, even when we have shifting weather patterns like this beautiful fall we're experiencing as we have less, unfortunately, as we have less and less snow during our winter months. Places like Emerald Bay absorb and are still destinations during the winter. Reducing wildfire risk and building forest resilience is obviously a major aspect, and we continue to talk about that daily. Increasing watershed resilience and biodiversity, upgrading our infrastructure to protect our vulnerable communities. You recently received a briefing from Kira Smith on our transportation equity plan. We're very much integrating the latest climate science and climate considerations within that equity study to ensure that the most vulnerable and underserved of our communities have the amenities they need. And then as everything we do, we are advancing science, stewardship, and accountability. And hopefully these categories sound familiar since it is all based off our environmental improvement program. And then just a couple examples of how we're turning science into policy and projects. With stormwater management, we know, and you can see in this graphic, that peak runoff, when we have our peak runoff in the season, is projected to change. Currently, peak runoff happens between May and July, with peak in June. Future climate projections show that peak is actually going to shift to January when we have our peak runoff. So building our infrastructure system, our BMPs, our stormwater systems, you can see the bottom left is a project Caltrans completed several years ago along US 50 in South Shore in order to capture runoff before it goes into the Upper Truckee River. And then on the right is Kale Drive, which I am ecstatically excited to say after many years, that project is now fully funded. So thank you to Mr. Rice on the call for getting that done. That's probably one of the most pressing examples of our failed stormwater infrastructure in our built environment. We can also talk about landslides. You can see here Logan Shoals several years ago during a heavy rain event in the winter had a large boulder fall on the highway, and it took several years for NDOT to repair that landslide slope. As part of the analysis we've done on climate in our highway corridors, that exact area was identified as a high risk for landslide area. So we're really seeing today that the climate projections and the climate data that we have are being seen in those areas that we predicted on the ground. And the key thing here with our transportation network is it costs a lot less to upgrade our infrastructure beforehand than repairing the damages afterwards. We also are utilizing our technology through the LT Info platform and the EIP project tracker. So the projects that are rolled up into our action strategy are all in a project list within the EIP project tracker. So we have anyone can go on and explore those projects in more details. And then it's also a dynamic living plan. As climate projects get completed, new ones can be added to that list and that prioritization. So when we're going after funding pots like the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act or the new Inflation Reduction Act and the historic climate money that's in California right now, we have a live up-to-date project list that all of our partners can know, hey, I've got a project. Oh, it's on this climate project. That opens up all these possibilities for funding programs. Moving on to the next subject for today, we've got a few updates is our climate resilience dashboard. We recently received a grant from the California Tahoe Conservancy to update and refresh our climate resilience dashboard. For our board members that may not be familiar, as part of the LT Info ecosystem, there is a sustainability dashboard that currently measures a number of metrics through the environment, communities, and economy, the triple bottom line. And this was created in 2014 along with our original sustainability action plan. Just pulling a snapshot out of here under community is transportation. Sorry for how small it looks, but that's the text is not important, but the importance is we're using metrics reported through project progress in the EIP project tracker to tell the story of sustainability at Tahoe. However, since 2014, not all of those metrics are either relevant anymore or data is not readily available. You can see within those three main categories, we have a variety of subtopics and 31 overall indicators. 10 of those, the data either doesn't exist anymore, the reporting from those sources has changed, or it's not necessarily relevant to what we want to be telling anymore. So under this project, we're going to be working with stakeholders to reevaluate and reexamine those metrics to better tell today's climate story. We're also going to sync those up and align them with other metrics. For example, the Tahoe Central Sierra Initiative has their pillars of resilience that cover both natural and community systems. And a lot of those metrics obviously overlap with the work we're doing here in Tahoe, but also the greater Sierra. California's Governor's Office of Planning and Research has recently released some of their metrics and metrics they're using to measure resilience as part of their new plan. The state of Nevada also has a set of metrics they're using. And then we also want to coordinate with the Prosperity Center and a lot of the economic metrics that they're measuring across the region. So again, as LT Info is a clearinghouse and a place to convene all of this data, how can we bring all these different pieces together to tell the story of climate resilience at Tahoe, but also tell it in a way that speaks to and recognizes the work that both states and the federal government are doing. There's lots of case studies that we can use to look at all, look at what we want to do in terms of functionality and tools. Some of these include Colorado's housing dashboard, which breaks things down at a county level. And then the Richmond, Virginia has a really good dashboard that breaks down the greenhouse gas emissions in a very user-friendly manner. We are proposing the categories to stick with the triple bottom line with a slightly different naming. This aligns with the categories that the state of California identified for their resilience metrics of the built environment, social systems, and natural systems. We also, around that, want to have ambient climate measures included in the dashboard, such as temperature, precipitation amounts, things that organizations like UC Davis, Turk, collect and report on. So you not only can see what's happening to our climate, what we're doing about it, and those results. And really at the center of that is that story of climate resilience. So now we're going to do a little interactive activity. We actually have two activities for you today. This one is going to be digital. So I see most folks have a computer out, so that's good. So if you don't have something out, you can do digitally. Grab that now. So we're going to do a digital exercise, getting some input up front early about what your priorities around resilience metrics include. And then I'll be handing it over to Jacob to do a more in-person activity. Yes, Ms. Conrad.
Just a quick question. I think of resilience as moving forward, right, preparing for the inevitable and ongoing impacts of climate change, whereas mitigation, which you addressed earlier, is about actually reducing emissions. How are, I mean, when you're asking us to take on this next discussion, you're calling this climate resilience, but you are reflecting on the mitigation measures and the output of those measures. How do you want us to do this exercise on mitigation, on resilience, on an integrated?
On both. On yeah, both. On okay. both. Integrate, put it all together. I think okay. when at least the trend is resilience has started to be more broadly encapsulating the mitigation, adaptation, and resilience. So that's, yeah, okay. all of it.
Just FYI, we're trying to call that actually integrated climate action through the U.S. Climate Alliance. So to use all three underneath one umbrella.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Let me switch my screen share. Okay, so as we did with the housing workshop last month or a couple months ago, we are going to be using Mentimeter to create a word cloud on what folks think under each of the categories. So if you go to menti.com, and those listening online can participate as well if they want to digitally, or those in the audience can participate, more input is always better. So go to menti.com and use code 6948-3936. Yes, I can zoom in on that too.
Oh, okay.
6948-3936. With an I, yes, menti.com. Not minty like the flavor.
Devin is actually doing a survey on governing board technical savvy for a conference. Just kidding.
All right, so if everyone's in, the first question is, what comes to mind when you think of a resilient built environment? So think some point in time into the future in your head, in your imagination, and I think you have five opportunities to use one or two words to describe how you would describe a resilient built environment. And as people, and if, I believe if you're doing it on mobile, if you hit enter, it'll just submit the first one you put in. So you have to hit done, not enter, on your mobile device.
It's 6948-3936.
All right, so we could see, I can zoom in again. We can see some answers popping up here. We've got walkability, stormwater infrastructure, future proof, long lasting, livable. We've got a few around, it keeps moving, more ideas coming in. Sustainable materials, coverage, green roofs, energy efficiency, BMPs, give that look at all this creativity we've got bubbling over here. So ultimately at this point, we're gaining input from you. We're going to start working with stakeholders through a process to develop a set of metrics. We're going to come back to this board with draft metrics at some point for additional input. So we do appreciate the upfront support. So if we'll give it one more minute for answers to get in. Six, nine, four, eight, three, nine, three, six. So like wildfire resilience popped up in there, bikeability, housing is making an appearance, efficiency is pretty big there, energy efficiency, bikeability, walkability, sustainable. So if everyone's had a chance to go in, we can go to our next question. Which should just automatically populate on your screen. But the next is, what comes to mind when you think of a resilient natural system? So now our natural system. All right, for natural system, we have things coming in like healthy, biodiversity, protected. Native species, vegetation management, strong, I like that word. After 2.5 years of pandemic, you think we'd have this figured out? All right, we can go on to our third and final question. What comes to mind when you think of a resilient social system? So now the social system. Integrated is holding strong right there in the center, along with accessible, inclusive, affordable, diverse, equity. I think I've also noticed a lot of crossover between the three categories and answers. There's a lot of crossover between those different metrics and measures. Okay, we'll give it one more second for folks to get their last thoughts in. Definitely a lot of came up about housing, workers is in there, diversity, a lot of equity questions or equity answers, family. Lots of great thoughts. So thank you all for sharing. I will now pull back up our slides. Yes, thank you. So as I mentioned, for the next steps, thank you for this initial input. We'll make sure that those final word clouds get into the meeting minutes and are accessible to the public that are watching. We're going to work to engage with stakeholders on getting more input on what's important to measure and the story of climate that we're trying to tell at Tahoe. We'll develop through input through the stakeholders and through your input as well next year, draft and final metrics. We'll collect the initial set of data for those metrics. And then develop that dashboard. And this new dashboard will replace the current sustainability dashboard on LT Info. So it'll still all be integrated within that system. Again, the benefit of that is as project partners report on their project progress and goals, that data is automatically added into the dashboard. So you get not quite a real time, but an annual refresh of that data to track the progress and the story of climate at Tahoe. So maybe before we move on to any the next topic, if there was just any additional thoughts. Yeah, Ms. Conrad.
Sorry, this is clearly my big area of interest where I spend most of my working time. So one thing I would say about the metrics and pillars and everything else as you look to integrate those is to really try to distill things to just a few that are most representative of improved, you know, quality of life in the built environment, natural environment, and that social cultural cohesion. In part, if you look at the TCSI pillars, for example, there are 10 around a wheel that don't necessarily show a framework. And so we did a lot of work a couple of years ago to indicate what the inputs and outputs might be and what the outcomes might be of those. So I would really think clearly about, you know, what are the outcomes of the projects that you're putting on the ground? What are the outputs? They're two different things. And so when you think about those indicators, really think broadly about the outcomes you're trying to hit, the values you're trying to reach, and really narrow it down as much as you can. I think that there's definitely an interest from OPR and others, and I am to blame in part for my time with the state of California and having a ton of these metrics. But ultimately, it's about accountability to people, to taxpayers, you know, to the species that we all care about. So if we can think about it that way very strategically, I think from a communications perspective, it's easier to talk about the benefit of the projects on the ground if you can really distill it and be simple in your messaging.
Yeah, absolutely. Inputs, outputs, outcomes. You are speaking TRPA's language. I'm sure Dan Segan is back at his desk right now smiling because that's the exact approach that we take to our threshold update and the threshold work he's doing and the exact pattern we're following for this.
It's as though Dan and I went to the same graduate school.
And she is a member of TUI Suite.
Perfect. Well, now I'm going to actually be handing it over for the next part of our presentation. To Jacob and online, our intern this summer, Cameron Cabosa. Sorry.
Thank you, Devin, for that introduction. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you for this opportunity to join in today. I will be talking about my work that I did over the summer with regards to climate resiliency policy and code amendments. So as Devin mentioned previously, one of the main documents that this work supports is the Sustainability Action Plan. And when I was brought on as an intern, there were about 70 amendment ideas that the Long Range Department had come up with initially. And those ideas fell into the categories on the right. So we have traffic congestion, which we also called VMT reduction, energy conservation, and energy generation, zero emission vehicles, waste diversion, sustainable construction and development, water conservation, carbon sequestration, forestry practices and vegetation, adaptation and resiliency, and affordable housing. Next slide, please. So I carefully looked through all of those ideas and I conducted internal and external research to refine those ideas. Internally, I spoke with various staff members to find out, you know, what were their needs, what were some of the things that they were hoping to potentially see as a code amendment or things that have come up in their work. I also looked externally at jurisdictions across the nation to see what they have done with similar initiatives, what they have done with their code or other programs. So I know it's kind of small, but this is a screenshot of my memo. So the memo includes the memo ideas in this format. So at the top, we have the amendment idea. So in this case, require benchmarking, auditing, and retrofitting of existing structures. We have the priority. So I marked it as short, medium, or long term. We have examples, which was a result of my external research. Survey results, which I will be talking about in a second. And at the bottom, we have alternatives. So what came from my internal and external research, as well as the survey, what I recommended we do to move forward. And some of those amendment ideas initially were better thought as projects or partnerships rather than amendment ideas at this time. So the survey we conducted on Qualtrics, we sent it out via email to about 190 to 100 various stakeholders around the basin. The stakeholders that we sent it out to fell into these categories, local governments and public services, nonprofits and community-based organizations, and private organizations, development organizations, which included architects, engineers, consultants. So the numbers at the bottom show how many responses we received from those stakeholders to the survey. So the methodology for the survey, as I said, was conducted on Qualtrics. So we were able to have the respondents kind of mark what their thoughts were for the amendment ideas that we included in the survey. So on the left, we had the amendment ideas. For example, require use of cool materials on roofing to reduce heat island effect. In the first column, they would mark how much effort and resources will this idea require to implement. So what they thought about that in terms of feasibility. Going from, you know, if they're not sure, little, moderate, or significant resources to implement that idea. In the middle, we have, if implemented, what type of climate resilience impacts will this idea have on the region? Again, those options were not sure, negative, insignificant, or positive. And at the right side, we have what is your or your organization's level of support for this idea, whether they do not support, they are neutral, or whether they do support. So this was the main structure for our survey, for all the questions and amendment ideas that we had in the survey. In the survey, we had 35 amendment ideas with opportunities at the end of each category to share their thoughts and additional ideas. So looking into the results by stakeholder group, something that came up quite often was focusing on reducing traffic congestion, and that was shared amongst all the stakeholder groups. Other popular ones were promote water efficient landscaping, supported by the NGOs and the private sector, as well as promote renewable energy, facilitate the transition towards electric vehicles, EVs, supported by the local government sector and private sector. And the other ones were promote zero waste for temporary events and continue focusing on workforce housing, which was shared upon the government and CDOs and nonprofit organizations. So looking at some additional comments, as I mentioned, there was many spaces for the respondents to include additional comments or additional ideas that they had. And these were some of the ones that popped out to me or that received most, they were quite popular. Better public transportation was one that was very popular. Looking at bus, pedestrian, and bike infrastructure. Enforcement is incredibly important, especially for temporary events and parking. Energy efficiency and possible amendment ideas regarding going all electric was kind of contentious. So looking at one comment was, all electric is very costly. It will be met with great resistance and is unrealistic. Another comment was energy efficiency is the key element over requiring all electric. And we just had some other interesting comments. I'll just mention there was some commentary on banning the use of fertilizers that contribute to algal blooms. And for more in-depth information, the memo that I produced at the end of my internship includes each amendment idea and research findings, as well as the overall survey results and more individual comments that were submitted as part of the survey. And with that, I will pass it over to Jacob.
Thanks, Cameron. Just so everyone knows, to be clear, Cameron was our intern over the summer. She's a graduate student from UC Davis, and yeah, she's pretty amazing. We're really privileged to get to work with her. And open invitation to Cameron to come back when she graduates and be a full-time planner with TRPA. I think the basin would really benefit from her continued work here. And more exciting news, we want to continue to build our relationship with UC Davis, particularly their graduate department of environmental policy and management. And so we've submitted an application to get a group of students to come and continue working on this project through their policy clinic program. And so, fingers crossed, you may be hearing from more Davis EPM grad students here in the coming year about this same work. So a great relationship that we're building right now. And for the record, my name is Jacob Stock. I'm a long-range planner with TRPA. And I'm going to be your entertainment for the rest of the afternoon. So everybody strap in. So here, yeah, I can do my slides here. So I'm here to lead a little activity where we'll share some ideas for developing what we call a climate smart code of ordinances. But most importantly, we really want to hear your ideas on an upcoming work plan for code amendments coming out of this climate program that you've heard a lot about today. So Cameron's research produced a lot of really amazing ideas of how we can build resilience and more climate smart policy here. And those ideas range from policy and code amendments to strengthening and even creating new programs and partnerships with other agencies. But in our first phase of implementing this research, we really want to focus on the ideas related to our code of ordinances. And I really want to stress here, too, that we're coming to you right now at a really early phase. I know John Hester mentioned this earlier. We're coming at an early phase of considering and scoping these ideas. And we really want your help fleshing out what we should be focusing on in a climate smart code. So these ideas aren't fully baked yet. And we want we think this could be a great opportunity to set early direction and get some of your input before we really get into the dirty work of putting these code amendments together. So we're going to do a little activity. Devin, do you want to flip these things over? So the big reveal, we have six broad themes for climate smart code amendments that we're going to be talking about today. I'll share some of our ideas under each theme area and ask for your thoughts. So maybe you have an idea of something you'd like us to add. Maybe you think we should be taking a particular direction. This is all input that we want to hear from you today. It's an opportunity to think about and start integrating your thoughts on climate smart regulations. So Devin will take notes. I'll present some of these ideas. We'll have a discussion. Devin will take notes. And finally, you'll have six dots, which Devin is handing out right now. And I'll ask that each of you at the end of the activity get up and put a dot next to the ideas that you think are most important for us to be focusing on. And, you know, obviously I will also be, you get six votes by right, but I'll also be selling extra votes if anyone is interested. Okay, we have some interest. It's a reasonable fee. We can talk, you know, we can talk off camera, off mic about that. No, just kidding. You get six votes. That's it. For those board members who are calling in, you can let Devin and I know what your votes are and we'll put them up for you. So let's get into some of this. So I also wanted to mention, you know, Cameron talked about a lot of themes in her research. There are a few themes that we won't be addressing in this activity, which did come up in Cameron's research. The first is waste aversion. We're not addressing this because it's really addressed pretty heavily through federal and state law, most notably through the Porter-Cologne Act. So we won't be focusing on waste diversion today. Water conservation is similarly a priority of the states. And workforce housing is obviously a major TRPA priority, but it's being addressed through our housing initiative. And as you all know, and you've all been involved with the slate of code amendments that they're working on. So they're working on a package as well. And I believe you guys have been informed about that work. So that's happening in parallel to this. Okay, so when we talk about a climate smart code, we're really talking about using TRPA's regulatory authority to support climate smart and resilient behavior and development in the basin. And so there are three main ways that we can encourage these types of resilient behaviors through the code. The first is by removing barriers in our code to performing those behaviors. So for example, roof pitch and material requirements can be a barrier to roof-mounted solar panels and cool roof construction. So we could remove barriers to that, for example. We can also create incentives for folks who want to do the right thing. So an example of that would be removing coverage requirements for EV charging stations. Yeah, you know, as you know, we require coverage for any ground coverage. If we exempted EV charging, then that would be an incentive for people to then put in EV charging stations, just as an example. Finally, we can simply make requirements. We can require that people do these behaviors. And so an example of that would be, you know, we could require that businesses provide bike parking, bike racks in front of their businesses. I'm not advocating for these ideas, just examples of what we're talking about here. But of course, code is not the only tool in our toolbox. We also have non-code tools. We can support education programs, projects, and partnerships that all encourage resilience and climate smart practices. But today, we are focusing on the code. So yes, the activity. So let's get started. I'll go over the slides and we can hear the ideas under each of these themes. And then if you all, as board members, have any comments, anything you want to see, any ideas, then I really encourage you to speak up at the end of each of these slides, and Devin will take notes. So our first theme, traffic congestion and VMT reduction. So this was an important topic to our survey respondents. Some code ideas from Cameron's research include requiring snow clearing on multi-use trails and sidewalks, traffic reduction measures for temporary events, including requirements for bike parking or visitor travel plans as a permit condition for temporary events, and also this broad theme of incentives for creating more bike and pedestrian-oriented town centers. So this could include requiring bike racks and EV charging stations, complete street style standards for pedestrian infrastructure, you know, like sidewalks of particular dimensions, and removing barriers to outdoor dining. And now this has been an important topic recently as the city of South Lake Tahoe's emergency order has expired. So we're currently interested in finding ways, if the board directs us to allow outdoor dining to continue even beyond the emergency order. So this is what we have for you under this topic, and I encourage any thoughts from the board. Yes.
Just a question on the VMT reduction. Where do these are great like carrots and great ideas, but where do the sticks come in? So the types of VMT reduction measures that make parking and driving less palatable than biking, walking, complete streets.
Yeah. So as you know, last year we adopted a new VMT standard, and that includes a VMT impact mitigation fee. And as part of that tool, when developers or project proponents want to develop a project, they go in, put in their location. It's actually a really cool interactive platform if you haven't played around with it. They put in their location, project type, and it creates a baseline VMT for that. And then from there, they can select, oh, I'm going to install bike racks. And that reduces the fee they have to pay. So there's a whole game there. So there's a lot that's already being done with VMT, which is why this one is really focused at some of the areas where that tool is already not targeting some more of those stick measures for VMT and the VMT mitigation fee. So as with housing, where housing, you've already given direction to the Tahoe Living Working Group on some code changes. We want to figure out ways we can add to the process and not duplicate. So some of those more stick ones, we're more than welcome to take all those ideas and draw them up here, but they do exist in some other places currently, but open to all and any ideas.
Okay, great. So like the conversations we've had around parking and congestion, that all essentially is handled elsewhere.
Yes, correct.
Okay, great.
Okay, mine's kind of similar too, about land use, which I think is probably what we've covered more in the housing discussions, but about incentivizing development in dense nodes in our downtown cores so that they're walkable and able to be served by transit. To me, that's super key. Is that, I guess, should it go on the list, or is that part of the housing code changes we're working on?
Yeah, this is, thank you for that comment. This is part of what I'm kind of calling the transportation, climate, housing nexus. So yes, we need to encourage more density in our town centers, and we're trying to hit that from all different angles. So I think that is something that belongs on the list here.
Yeah, totally. And then all of those housing measures that are looking at that then could be replicated for commercial businesses and mixed use that the housing initiative doesn't necessarily touch. We can play that success, use the success on that analysis to expand those measures as the board sees fit.
Maybe this is just a matter of semantics, but The third bullet point is incentivize walk and bikeability in down and town centers, but an incentive is not a requirement typically. And then you have a list of requirements. So I think we're kind of mixing metaphors here, so to speak. If a true incentive is something that, you know, is the carrot as opposed to the stick. And I always prefer to lead with the carrot and then follow up with the stick. Not to say that these ideas aren't laudable, but I just think we need to couch them differently.
Right. Thanks for catching that, sure. Because those are our semantics, yeah.
Also, I think maybe just because of your talking about the nexus, it might be interesting to include by reference some of the other areas where VMT is addressed, where all of these are addressed, just in the report itself too. And then same thing in those other reports, just so everyone can see that nexus very clearly.
Yes, I'm sorry, Belinda.
That's okay. Here as well, is there a way to have a stick that says you're going to be promoting programs which expand bike sharing, e-bike use, that type of thing? I know that down in our area, one of the Council of Governments was able to establish an e-bike program where basically you can get a free e-bike for 6 months, and hopefully that incentivizes more people to be able to use it.
Yes, absolutely. We always work with our partners, the Tahoe Bicycle Coalition. They do volunteer and have bunch of bike valets at many events throughout the community. We do have also on the list the e-bike charging. That's definitely an emerging thing. And I know the program that launched that was giving e-bikes out for free for certain users, they actually, I believe that program just received a $200 million statewide grant to expand statewide. So I'm very carefully watching that as a firm believer in e-bikes and their future to their potential to transform mobility to bring a program like that to Tahoe.
Great. Sue.
And I'm going to go back to my roots in Colorado, saying that in part of the incentivizing for walkable, bikeable areas is using nonprofit. They have nonprofits there that work with bicycles to get commuter bikes for the communities. And it's very successful, and it's in every community. There are commuter bikes, bike racks, and all that. And I think that's a part of that, but I didn't see that specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's that line between what is a program versus what is a code update. So we'll mark it down, but then understanding, does our code contain language that says we must have volunteer programs, or do we just use through our transportation demand management program, right. Engage?
Yeah, I was thinking more of a good incentive.
Yeah.
Be that you promote. Using that word promote.
Okay, Jim, and then Alexis.
Cool. Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation. Personally, I find this a little tricky because the climate is such an overarching umbrella over everything. And I do get concerned about keeping things straight as far as, you know, the difference between the Tahoe Forest Action Plan and the Environmental Improvement Plan and the Climate Resiliency Plan and the Aquatic Invasive Species Plan. And they all have dollar amounts attached to them, and they all add up to more than the EIP because we're kind of like, I don't know where forest health fits anymore. What is the forest health expense part of the climate plan? Is it part of the forest health plan? Is it part of the EIP? And I think moving forward, I do have a request that we kind of get a little more clearer on exactly how all of these pieces fit together. That being said, I do just clarification. So the first bullet is snow clearing on multi-use trails and sidewalks. I'm assuming you're meaning in urban areas if this is traffic congestion and VMT reduction, because we had a long discussion about the East Shore Trail this morning. And I know a lot of folks want state parks to keep that clear. There's a lot of issues with that. And, you know, I would contend that keeping that East Shore Trail clear in the wintertime doesn't do a lot for VMT reduction. So, because nobody's walking from Incline Village to Sand Harbor to go to work.
Yeah,
so,
no, absolutely.
I don't know what the intent is there, so maybe some clarification. And then the second bullet, sub-bullet under the second bullet of a visitor travel plan. What is a visitor travel plan for a temporary event? Is that a traffic and circulation plan, or is it that each visitor has to map out where they're going to go?
No, I don't
know what that is.
No, for your first question, obviously snow clearing is something that
We have snow, and the Placer County, Tahoe City PUD does snow clearing in the winter. El Dorado County and the city of South Lake Tahoe do snow clearing. It's expensive, so we do prioritize those areas closer to urban areas, especially connecting to neighborhoods where we know our car-free homes are, because those folks are the ones that absolutely rely on that trail network in the winter to get to work and to activities. So yes, I think the urban commute trails are more of a priority than some of our rural recreation trails. Yeah, correct.
Can I just say, because for El Dorado County, we clear from Myers all the way into town, and it gets used. It's becoming more and more popular as people are finding that. And also between one business to the other, people will park their car in one spot and be able to walk from one business to the other. That would not happen if we were not clearing those walkable areas in the winter. So I think it does help with VMTs in some way.
No, I'm just saying the East Shore Trail would not help with VMTs. And that's why, and I just want a clarification, what type of multi-use trails are we talking about clearing? I'm on board with multi-use trails reducing VMT.
And then for the your question on the visitor travel plans, that would be a condition for the actual event host, where they would have to identify, hey, we reached out to the local transportation agency to ensure that our event is promoting their bus routes, and we have a bus schedule readily available when we sell people tickets, that we have a bike valet available that we're promoting. And when you purchase a ticket, when you get your follow-up confirmation email, it's like, here's how to travel to and from the event, and that they're coordinating with our local transit agencies in order to make sure that that runs seamlessly. So that's more of a less of the event goer's responsibility and more of the event thrower's responsibility.
Alexis.
Thank you. I was thinking that it would be great on that additional requirements for pedestrian infrastructure like sidewalks and wayfinding. I think that is really impactful for local governments to see how we can do that. And that's something that perhaps could be our bonus, you know, allocation every year. We could look at that. Not that I'm looking to get my local government in trouble, but the same thing you could do with the snow clearing, which Washoe County is looking at. How do we do a better job on clearing our multi-use paths? And we're supposed to have a plan that will come out of that. But and then finding resources that we could share with other governmental entities. Who else is doing snow clearing on these multi-use paths? Or are they contracting with a private agency that we should work with, like Clean Tahoe that we've worked with because the rest of the lake has worked with as well? And then on the requiring bike racks, and I love bike racks because I used to do arts and culture for a city, and we did a lot of art bike racks. It's tough with e-bikes. I have an e-bike and it has huge tires, and I can't even put my e-bike on most bike racks. So I want to make sure what we're requiring makes sense and that will be used. And I just want to really think that through, especially with the charging as well. I don't need to charge my e-bike except at home. I'm not like going around the lake, but I am going quite a few places during the day. So just some thoughts that I had. Thank you.
Other comments, board members on this one? Anybody online? Wes or Barbara? Oh, I'm sorry. Bill? I'm sorry. I looked for the light.
You know, I'll push the light. So, Devin, I mean, you gave a good example on BMT, how we were going to use the mitigation fee. And it provides the project proponent a range of things to do to reduce the fee, which also benefits our VMT reduction. And here I kind of agree with Shell. I'm trying to figure out the require, incentivize, require language here. Because in that context, require means that you want something from us. You want a permit. So what is going to be the project that then we would say to Placer County, you need to require snow clearing on multi-use trails and sidewalks? I mean, what is the trigger for that requirement?
That is a great question. I think
that's what codes are for, right?
That's part of what we're exploring and the feedback that we want from you. I know in the city of South Lake Tahoe, we do have the requirement that businesses clear the sidewalks of snow in their businesses. And I think
the what they're getting from us and what we view is we want to, the business wants to continue operating in our city. We want you to keep the sidewalk clean. So that's the, and there's a fine associated with that for
so
multi.
In our, for example, in our regional plan, why not put an amendment and an area plan, which city of South Lake Tahoe would come in. And we'd say, well, one of the things that needs to be part of your area plan is snow clearing on multi-use trails and sidewalks. That's not a code issue. That really is a plan that's going to, I mean, and in our regional plan, that when you come in for an amendment to your area plan, we think in order to help with our overall climate resiliency, that South Lake Tahoe needs to do that, or Placer County needs to do that, or Douglas County needs to do that. I mean, that's where I'm trying to figure out if you were coming to our PIC with a code amendment, like, okay, well, what's TRPA's nexus to this requirement?
Yeah, and that's exactly what, I don't know that I have a solid answer for that, but that's exactly what we're trying to figure out with this process, and your feedback so critical is, yes, no, we all can maybe, I think we can all agree that snow clearing on trails is good and important, especially for those that don't have cars, but where is the most appropriate place for that to live? Is it really a code? Where's the carrot? Where's the stick? Does it belong in our plans? Is it more of a local jurisdictional issue where some of the local jurisdictions are already doing that using funding that they have? So do we necessarily, if all the local jurisdictions are already doing it, do we really need to make it a requirement if it's already happening? You know, those are the things we're going to answer through this process. So I appreciate the critical questioning of what the intent of some of these are. I do appreciate it.
But those that are already doing it would love an incentive. Okay, Shelley, I'm sorry.
You know, I'm all for removing barriers to expanded outdoor dining and retail, but I don't understand how that addresses traffic congestion. I mean, when you go to a restaurant, you're offered an opportunity to sit inside or outside. I mean, it's great for the business, and obviously was implemented to deal with the COVID restrictions. I think it's a great idea, but I'm not sure it fits within the context of VMT reduction.
Is it, I was thinking the same thing. Is it because most of the time when they've expanded outside, they're in parking spaces that were previously required to be open for parking, and therefore you're reducing parking and incentive? I don't know. I was trying to figure out that nexus.
That is one of the pieces is using street parking for outdoor dining. The other piece is just this idea of street activation and public space activation as an incentive for active transportation.
Okay.
Well, I think it needs to be clarified then, Jacob. I mean, in other words, if you're putting together a list of incentives, then it should say that, you know, one of the incentives for putting in bike racks and e-bike charging is that you're going to be allocated a certain number of outside parking spaces. In other words, use that as an incentive to promote other items on the list.
That's a good idea.
And it looks like you're about to to go. I was going to come up with another. Go ahead.
I'm getting hyper-specific here, but I'll share it since I now have a microphone on. I've noticed going to concerts over the summer in South Lake, right, or at State Line specifically, people don't like using the bike racks with their e-bikes because there's these anecdotal stories of someone picking up the entire bike rack with the e-bikes and putting that in a truck. I guess someone saw that once. So the casinos had started coat checking e-bikes, which people love. So again, hyper-specific example, but as we're talking about e-bikes, recognizing that value, either having things really cemented in or something where we recognize the value of an e-bike could be very high. So hyper-specific, but an example I saw this summer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even with multifamily housing, it goes beyond just having a bike rack outdoor. It goes to having a secure bike rack where there's fencing around it, where it's locked, where it's indoors. So that's definitely something we see. And when we say bike valet, like bike parking bike valet, the valet is that coat check.
Did you have another? Just going back to our earlier conversations on the transit and temporary permit, looking at how we require or incentivize, I'm not sure which, participation by employers in carpool programs, rideshare programs, alternative to single vehicle use.
Yeah, programs. Absolutely. We didn't.
And you're working on that already, I know. But does it make sense in code or not? I don't know, you know. And again, is it an incentive or a requirement?
Yeah, absolutely. Our transportation team is busy developing the pilot of the Commute Tahoe program, which I know they've engaged some local businesses in that pilot, such as the League to Save Lake Tahoe. We do currently have that a code requirement that employers over, I believe it's 100 employees, do have a commute program for their work. And I know our transportation team is working as part of RTP implementation on strengthening that program and potentially bringing back maybe a little bit stronger code language that enforces that.
And for those large employers that can work, I think for so many of our small businesses, maybe they need an incentive to also participate, because then we could look at those parking lots or parking locations outside the basin and start having some funding or opportunity to see those used better. So,
yeah, we can definitely explore that. We have 5 more topics.
Well, this was number one on everybody's list. Yeah, so, you know.
Of course.
Real quick. It dawned on me when we're talking about electric bikes. The issue, one of the biggest issues we have right now is where can you ride them? So I think if we can get some sort of code, and I don't know if we can work with all the agencies, but we need to address a universal code for bike trails in particular right now.
Absolutely.
Going all over the place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Jessica, I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand before.
No, that's okay. I just raised it and I will be quick so we can move on to the other 5 categories. Piggybacking a little bit off of a subject we talked about this morning, and I'm apologize if I sound like a broken record as one of the resident parents of young children in the group. But I would just want to maybe suggest, instead of focusing so much on just bikes and e-bikes and scooters, like non-vehicle modes of transportation, speaking from personal experience, I would be able to reduce a lot of vehicle miles traveled if there were like accessible ways to get my children places other than just in my car, which can hold 7 people, but with 2 car seats can functionally only hold 4 people. And so, you know, having places for people to put wagons, strollers, all kinds of devices that people use to transport humans, wheelchairs, you know, wide enough sidewalks, just sort of focusing on broadly wheeled vehicles that are not automobiles, something like that, because you cannot take, you know, a baby in an Uber unless you bring a car seat with you and then you're walking around with it. But if you have a stroller, you can go on the bus or whatever, but not if you can't fit the stroller on the bus.
And MicroMass Transit doesn't have stroller access.
Yes.
You're right. You're absolutely
and
right.
And you
see,
cannot.
I'm a grandmother now. I'll get to experience that the next summer. But
and then the other issue is you get to the restaurant or whatever, and then the restaurant is grumpy that you have a giant stroller that you need to park somewhere in the restaurant.
Right.
So you know, especially for event planning, like having a bike valet that you could also like leave a stroller at is basically what I'm getting at for that one. But
right.
Yeah. And just, you know, I think it really could reduce a lot of vehicle miles traveled if it were easier to transport tiny humans in a way that wasn't just a personal automobile. So.
Great. Great comments. I'm not seeing others unless Wes or Barbara, I haven't seen your hands go up, but please chime in if you have.
Yeah, my hand hasn't gone up, but I'm sitting here wondering. With all these e-bikes running around and all of the e-scooters running around, and maybe I'm being self-centered here, but seems to me that there's a lot of older folks that frequent the basin and or live in the basin, and not being as agile as some of us used to be, dodging these damn things can be a real problem. And I think that we should come up with some reasonable codes as to where you can ride them and where you can't ride them. I know that they come into Douglas County where we have no ordinances about these things at all, and you find them dumped all over the place. So one of my concerns would be regulation this to all these wonderful electronic devices of where they can be used and where they should not be used.
Thank you, Wes. Yeah, the e-mobility devices are definitely an emerging trend and a challenge managing them across the country. And there's two sides of that coin of managing how people use them, but then also being able to provide the infrastructure that allows people to use them more safely. If you're only providing one narrow sidewalk, it does create more user conflicts. But if you have a sidewalk with a designated lane, then you can have more of that separation where everyone can enjoy the street. And that is really what all of our complete street projects in Tahoe are about. So we can mark that on the sheet, and it's noted, Ms. Rice.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wes. I'm not seeing any other hands or lights, so Jake, go ahead.
All right, next topic. Thanks for all the ideas, you guys. This is going to have some interesting, really interesting research ahead of us. The next topic is localized energy generation. So this is an important topic where we think we could have a lot of impact through the code. Our first idea is to look at removing barriers to small-scale energy generation. So for example, we could do more to support metering systems that could offset grid power at important institutional facilities like South Tahoe Refuse or the community college, for example. And so this could include standards for small-scale biomass facilities or wind generation or solar energy facilities as well. Solarization can also come up against our scenic standards. That's been a pretty frequent topic recently. So defining preferred materials, reflectivity, and even code interpretations for our scenic rules as they relate to solar panels could be a priority for us. Solar and wind structures also come up against our height standards. So we could provide additional height allowances for these structures as appropriate. And finally, a requirement. We could require large buildings and parking lots to include solar. Other jurisdictions have done this in the country, and so it's had some success. So it's something we could consider as well. And I welcome any thoughts from the board.
Yes, Shelley.
Don't you think that there is an incentive for some of these buildings to install these solar panels because it offsets their energy, reduces their energy costs. So I'm not sure a requirement would be necessary. I think it's just a code change that would allow them to be installed. And how do you deal with reflectivity issues? I mean, you're talking about amending the scenic ordinance, but that's for the unit itself. It doesn't address the glare that can come off of these panels.
Yeah, we've been doing some research into that, and there's products on the market where you can put a film on the solar panel, similar to like a tinting, that does reduce the reflectivity there. I think the big thing here is just making sure that we understand, or at least are being clear with potential permittees, that this is the standard we're expecting, and here's ways that you can meet it. You could use X product, Y product, position it at this angle versus that angle. And that may even just be as simple as a fact sheet that says, here, you're thinking about solar. Here's all the things to consider, and here's how to meet our scenic standards. Or it could go further into code changes. But yeah, that reflectivity, there are some products on the market that deal with that.
Thanks, Don. Anyway, my suggestion would be, you know, the virtue of installing solar panels, if you can afford to install them, is that it'll reduce your energy costs. So I'm not sure it should be a requirement.
Yeah, and an interim step there too could just be requiring a new construction, the wiring, pre-wiring for the infrastructure. So that's a lot less cost on the project component. And then if someone does eventually want to install solar, that makes installing the solar later a lot cheaper as well. You could do the same with electric vehicle infrastructure.
Okay, Bill and then Vince.
Yeah, I think... I guess my question is on wind, the reality of wind. And I know the coast is going to wake up to wind, and that'll be an issue as they have already proposed lease sales off of the coast for wind power. But can't imagine it in lake. I mean, there's wind. I know when I was chair, I got a phone call from a guy who was really all excited about doing a wind project near Marlette. And how much would that, what would be our reaction to that? I said, I really don't know, but that the scale is significant. And then of course, there's really no way to hide, the wind turbines. You know, you have to go to Altamont or, the Delta and see them. And then there's for those of us that like birds, as a serious downside.
Yeah, the giant white windmills that you're used to seeing in the windmill farms out in the valleys, those are never going to be feasible in Tahoe. There are, in terms of this code change, there are some new technologies that are these cylindrical spirals that are more small scale for individual homes that could work. We do have wind up here. The problem and challenge with wind energy is we get very gusty wind and it's not consistent. So it's not necessarily the best for energy generation. We just want to make sure as we're researching it, that our code isn't getting in the way of some of these new novel technologies. But one of the big giant windmills, you know, those aren't going to be feasible at Tahoe. So we're not anticipating that. We're looking at some of the smaller scale individual home generation technology that's coming out.
Even some of the early versions of Altamont had really small egg beater type things. They were the worst on eagles and hawks. Yeah. And so, I mean, it kind of depends. I question wind. I see solar as and the biomass, just because we have so much as a result of Caldor and other things. But weren't we thinking about opening up the tribe was going to open up a biomass in Carson City or Carson somewhere?
It's in Douglas County, and it's actually a sawmill site now. I mean, that, looking at biomass facility, moving it from the east at the Northern Nevada Correctional Center, there is some studies to maybe see opening up, but what's being built now or being contemplated is not a biomass facility as much as it is a sawmill.
That's a fairly significant industrial thing, I would assume, for the basin.
Yeah, I think in that example and the wind example, scale really makes a big difference.
There's a lot of interesting technology on the hydro conversion for hydro. I'm sorry, what do you call it? No. Biomass that just goes directly into
gasification.
Not gasification.
Pyrolysis.
I'm going to get there. You're going to confuse me more.
I mean, yeah, there are some of those small scale facilities that are the size of a shipping container that can generate power. It's not going to generate all of our power, but you know, it could, for example, at a transfer station for a waste company that is already taking in all of the pine needles and yard debris in Tahoe, they could, instead of trucking it over the hill, they could generate enough energy on site. You know, given all the other constraints that we have in the basin with air quality concerns and offset some of their onsite energy.
I know North Star Community Services District and the Truckee Tahoe Airport are doing that. They're going to convert the biomass directly into the heated water that they put. What is it? Well, it's not geothermal, but they're taking the water, but instead of converting it to electric heat, basically to heat the walkways in North Star Village and the airport on the runway. And then they're also looking at it. So it's smaller scale, very small scale.
District heating system.
Yeah, the cogeneration.
We have the cogeneration. So instead of generating the power, because that you lose, I guess, a lot of the convert. See how little I know. Other than there are new technologies coming out all the time for the biomass, and it really is small scale. And movable. They're even talking the movable system. So
I wanted to promote biomass just because we have so much of it, and having just cut down 60, almost 65 dead trees on our property, you know, and there's no use for any of that. You know, it's just going right to landfill right now. You know, it would be great I think that needs to be separate, because I think that's part of the forestry, you know, all the forestry health projects that we have. We have to have some place to put all that stuff, something to do with it.
So on this one, if you want to vote for one of these ideas that has the biomass, wind, solar, if you put your dot right on the act, word of the one you really like, we can glean that.
Because I wanted to separate that out. You know, and one thing that upset, I was trying... Solar doesn't really work on our house. We just get too much snow. It would destroy the panels. And I imagine that's true at a lot of places up here. But so I reached out to the utility about community solar, and there was no community solar up here, which kind of surprised me, being in California. And so I think that's something that we need to look at, because the panels are going to be much more efficient down in Reno, providing power up here, you know, way more efficient than putting it on everyone's roof up here. So I think I think we should be looking at that. And then the other thing that I think is going to be interesting that's going to be coming up is bi-directional charging equipment for EVs, because why build a $1 billion battery plant when you can just get 10,000 Tesla owners to opt in and use their cars to store up and then discharge when there's no sun. So, but that's going to take a little bit of, so any charging equipment that we require or incentivize, I think we should be pushing to make it bi-directional as soon as those standards come out.
John, and then Sue.
Question on coverage for whatever renewable energy facility is deployed or proposed to be deployed. I see on the next slide, looking ahead, there's coverage exemptions proposed for EV infrastructure. How about for renewable facilities? That would be, you know, if you solar storage.
Yeah, coverage is covered under the bucket of remove barriers for small scale energy generation. So that for solar is either coverage for ground mounted solar or height for roof mounted solar.
But okay. I would add that on there just so we can be sure to consider that.
I would just, as Devin well knows, you know, I've mentioned this here before, the city passed 100% 24/7, mean all time periods, renewable energy by 2030. To do that, you really need round the clock generation. Renewables does not equal natural gas. So we're talking biomass, pumped hydro. We have mountains. You have a reservoir on top and one at the bottom, and you work with the gravity to generate electricity. So it's an emerging technology. It's being deployed in more places. We have mountains and we have trees. So these are opportunities. Another type of technology that might in the future require some kind of code flexibility to deploy. And I'm certainly just in favor in general, if we're serious about climate, I think when in doubt, we need to err on the side of allowing renewable deployment. So choosing solar, say solar is a scenic asset, because that means we're fighting climate change. It's not a blight. And just kind of reinterpreting all these things. So I'm personally in favor of maximum flexibility for all these zones.
And I'm trying to invent this, Sue and Jim too. Okay. And then
I don't know how we do it. I have a question mark on this one, but it drives me crazy, is not just for solar, but for a lot of reasons in our lake, pollutants and all that, solar boats. How do we incentivize solar on our lake? Incredibly important, and I think it would solve a lot of other issues other than just solar power. I know it's probably way out there, but I don't know how we incentivize it.
Yeah, that's really interesting in terms of solar on the lake. Yeah. I mean, even tidal wave power generation, maybe that's something in our lake if it ever mixes again. But a little spoiler alert, on the EV chart, we do have electric boat charging.
Oh.
And
okay.
And Homewood Marina won a Best in Basin award this year for their e-boat charging.
We should incentivize the heck out of all that.
Was I next? Jim, I think, and then Haley.
And thanks, Madam Chair. You're doing a phenomenal job keeping track of all of us. I'm amazed. You know, I guess I'm going to struggle on this one with my dots, quite honestly. I'm going to have extras. So, I mean, I like all of these ideas, but I do get concerned. You know, we are an environmental agency with a lot of thresholds across the board regarding scenic quality, water quality, you name it, air quality. I think energy generation in the basin is something to be looked at, but we have to be mindful of the trade-offs. And so, you know, I can sit here and easily say, yeah, incentivizing solar rooftop panels is a good thing. Does one primary residence going to solar, is that a big enough advantage to Tahoe to basically do away with scenic standards or height standards? That's quite honestly, that's where I'm struggling, is how much does energy generation in the basin help with our climate resiliency plan? I can get behind biomass, but, you know, Bill brought up wind, and yeah, philosophically, yeah, you know, more diverse renewables is great.
but not at the expense of everything else. And so I don't see that sort of in the mix. When I hear like, well, let's relax the standards, you know, perhaps the environmental document for those code change would address that. But I just don't want to lose sight of that. We have to make sure that we're getting the benefits, you know, are going to outweigh the cost to the other thresholds.
I know you've previously worked at TRPA because that is exactly the concern our current planning department brought up when we were discussing with them is, yes, if one house does it, but then all of a sudden every house does it, where's that cumulative impact? Where's the impact? You know, and the South Tahoe Public Utility District, they just approved to move forward with a 1 megawatt solar facility on some of their land. So I think there's going to be a couple upcoming projects in the region that really will help us examine those bigger basin concerns with an actual project to look at and talk through all those policy decisions.
I think it was Haley and then John.
Thank you. And this is just a clarification. When it says Community Solar Nevada, we actually have, you can't do Community Solar Nevada. You'd have to change the statute. But what we do is expanded solar access, where you have sites, solar facilities offsite that people that are low income or work or own a disadvantaged business or certain other categories can buy into solar coming off of other places. They're really specific rules. I refer you to your friendly PUC to find them. But just a clarification on that, that does exist in Nevada under a different name, but it's got really specific parameters around it already. And this, it just came up the last legislative session. So just point on that.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. John?
And then Sue, your light's on.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay.
Just want to, say a word on the climate resilience and renewables in the basin. The more electricity we generate here and store for nighttime usage, the less we have to import on transmission lines that are coming through forests, the same sort that have burned down countless California communities. That's certainly part of the South Lake Tahoe thinking on our resolution was to, I mean, in an ideal world, you would be able to generate all your own electricity locally such that you were less and less dependent on those high fire risk transmission of electricity. So that's really a fundamental part of resilience in my view, and avoiding the ultimate scenic blight of catastrophic wildfire, burning down forests. So I would just say that, I would just think of that in terms of a reason to promote local generation as an imperative. And then on the requirement, California does have this California solar mandate. It took effect 2 years ago for all new single family homes and multifamily buildings over 3 stories. I could see, just Shelley, as you mentioned before, trade-offs like, hey, if you do this thing with bikes or e-bikes, then maybe you get some allowances with parking. You know, there's lots of things that are put on the table, including funding, and we're looking at now density coverage and height allowances for multifamily. One could imagine packaging that with a solar or energy efficiency requirement to say if you're going to add impacts for more people and more cars and more density and more runoff, then you have to offset it with renewable energy and efficiency. So
since you mentioned energy efficiency, maybe good to transition to the next one.
Well, Jessica,
sorry, I don't want to cut any of the ideas off, but yeah.
I just had one small thing on the first one, since we do have specific call outs to different kinds of energy. I just want to make sure that we're not excluding emerging technologies. And I apologize if I missed this and I was out of the room for a second. But for example, as a side note, the company I work for in my day job is involved primarily in geothermal, which I'm not suggesting we drill in Lake Tahoe Basin, don't worry. But we also do waste heat recovery, which is primarily utilized in industrial settings, but can be used on things like hospitals, casinos that generate a lot of heat and just send it out into the atmosphere. And there are there's technology to capture that heat and turn it into energy.
So. Yeah, Cindy brought that example of North Star and the airport doing that to use for the heated sidewalks.
Go ahead.
Excellent. So let's move on to energy conservation then. Parallel to energy generation. So we may consider incentives for increased energy efficiency. So that's pretty
That's pretty broad, so I'll give some examples. This could include coverage exemptions or other bonuses for energy efficient design, for example, building thicker walled structures to accommodate better insulation. We could provide a coverage exemption for that potentially. We could require new construction to be 100% electric. That's been done elsewhere, and so we could consider that as well. We could also consider a mitigation fee or additional development rights for very large residences, and this has been tried in other mountain towns, most prominently Vail and Aspen have done this. And we could align our exterior lighting requirements with energy efficiency and dark sky standards, and this would be a relatively easy lift for us. We had an analysis recently that said we're close to dark sky, but not quite there. So I think there's some small changes we could make to get there.
Shelley?
Somebody sent me a funny photo. It was of a gas vehicle towing a diesel generator, re-energizing an electric vehicle. And when I look at 100% electric for all new construction, I mean, where is that electricity? How is that electricity being generated? Is it being directed from solar power, wind power, or is it being generated from gas? So, and I understand our focus is on the Tahoe Basin, but ultimately, if you look at it holistically, a lot of our electricity comes from gas. So, it's a bit of a conundrum. How do you go 100% electric and have absolutely no impact on the environment? I don't think you can unless it's generated by wind or solar. So either we need to kind of, be a little more specific about what we need, or we need to I don't know, my instincts tell me just to eliminate it. But that's okay. I have a dot, so I don't have to vote for it.
I've got a comment on that. So it depends where you are, obviously, because like mm-hmm. in PG&E's service territory, I think they're way below 25% comes from burning fuel. So, the electricity is really clean. And the thought is, over time, electricity is getting cleaner. But once you put in a furnace or a hot water heater that's gas, they have a long lifespan. So you got to, and people will keep replacing them with those same. So if out now, then over the long term, it'll save a lot. So that's one thing on that, which is why people are pushing for it, because right now it doesn't make sense in a lot of areas at this time, but over the lifespan of those appliances, it makes sense. The other one, a lot of these things, there's a new California's Title 24 is being updated at the end of the year, and the requirements, I mean, right now, if you build, you're already like, I don't know, lead silver, if you just build a house under current. And with the new codes, like, you have to insulate normally and sheet the entire building and bridge it. And you can't actually pass if you put in a gas appliance like a furnace or a hot water heater. So I think California has solved our problem on that part of the lake for us. So we aren't going to have to probably require anything or incentivize anything there. I have no idea how Nevada is by comparison. So it might be just on that side of the lake. We need to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know some of the local jurisdictions on the California side are also, like the city of South Lake Tahoe, is actively developing a reach code that goes even beyond that Title 24. So this, may be one of those items that the board and the direction we make at this board for policy is that that's being handled at a local jurisdiction level. And our role is more of a support role in that.
Just to follow up, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Obviously, what happened in California during the heat wave. The government asked everyone to not charge their EVs. Well, that, given the state of technology today, it places people in a very vulnerable position, and I know for myself at my home, because electricity, goes off, goes on. Nevada Energy is relatively efficient and reliable, but there are times when the electricity goes off. So we install the gas generator so that we don't lose all the food in our freezer. So we, from a practical standpoint, it makes sense to have alternative sources of energy. And that's what worries me about this push for all electricity, because a lot of the electricity is generated from fossil fuels currently. Maybe that won't be the case in the future. So I think that we need, in my mind, we need to focus on the bigger picture and not just what's good for the Tahoe Basin.
Can I just jump in? I think so. Yes. And there's also a lot of research and data on indoor air quality from gas appliances making indoor air quality worse, right? There's actually a public health indication for moving to all electric as well, right? And thinking about that gas generation, it does have public health and air quality impacts. So the move towards all electric, yes, there are reliability issues that we still have to ink out and work out. And this longer term play, the more communities that can go towards all electric, the more demand there will be for fixing some of those issues. But I think when you think about some of the public health issues, and they're really large, especially for indoor air quality, it really is important for us to do everything we can to move in that direction while dealing with some of those reliability issues. And to be fair, when Californians responded to that request, we did it. Right. So there is a collective response, and a state of 40 million people responded and we kept the lights on. So we do have some good stories to tell. Additionally, when I think about, generation, we're not China. We're not getting our electricity from coal. We're moving cleaner and cleaner. We're keeping some of these, dirtier natural gas facilities online specifically for backup generation. Right. So we are thinking long term about how you ensure reliability. But, the more you can actually get gas lines out of your house, you're also protecting yourselves and your communities too. Think about the gas explosions we've seen. So just moving in that direction has any number of benefits, from indoor air quality, from public safety, reducing infrastructure that we need underground in an earthquake prone state, things like that. So I just thinking about the bigger picture and the longer term, I really encourage us to do that.
Haley wanted to jump in, and then Vince. And then John.
more public service announcements from a friendly PUC. So we are studying this, the future of natural gas. We have a docket open at the commission. We were asked to open it by the governor at the end of last session because there was a bill pending in Nevada that was going to look at either ending natural gas or fully electrify. It did not pass. It did not get out of committee. And what the governor asked at that point is the PUC looked at things like stranded assets. When you're paying for gas lines that you've already paid for 50 years, how much is that going to cost people? Reliability, some of our mobile home parks that still rely on propane, like to even go backwards. So all this to say is that it is being studied. There's a conglomerate of six states that are looking at this across the West. Nevada is, I would put us squarely in the study mode, whereas California is in the more implementation mode. So this might also be something that our state is just studying at this point, because to your point, full electrification, we're not as clean as PG&E right now. I think we set at about 70% natural gas that we still burn. So it is something that I think you're right, in the state of Nevada probably is going to take a longer look. And I think it's good that we're looking at that statewide. That's not to say that locally we can't support, encourage, see what's happening across the border, learn is probably the best verb I can look for, to see how California has implemented this and to see some of those issues. I know that's our commission is looking at the California Commission, who also has been studying this. So I wonder if this isn't something that we don't continue to gather lessons on, but that might just particularly be an area where California has taken steps that our state is continuing to study in that mode.
And it could also be an incentive program. Our wood stove replacement program, an incentive program that TRPA helps manage, has been a rousing success. I think we've replaced most, if not all at this point, old wood stoves in the basin with EPA certified wood stove. So maybe it's transitioning. Hey, we've got all this money that was going towards wood stove replacement. There's not a lot of wood stoves left. Now let's start incentivizing electric conversion. And instead of requiring it, as we've been doing our verbs, that could be an incentive program for people to swap out their inefficient gas water heater when it breaks with an all new electric pump.
So coupled with that, though, John brought up the issue of electric lines above ground. Ultimately, those lines should be underneath the ground, right? Because we have a potential of a catastrophic fire, in the Tahoe Basin, if weather ever returns to normal, and I'm always optimistic, optimistic. Yes, thank you. Optimistic about the prospects. Okay, it'll be mutual. Okay, being all electric, if the electricity goes down and you don't have a stove, that could leave people with no heat at all, during a massive snowstorm. So, there are public health issues too that I think have to be considered. And actually, I'm encouraged that California, you know, has elected at least temporarily not to shut down its last nuclear plant, because that's a very clean, obviously there's some dangers inherent in nuclear energy, but it's a very clean form of energy. So I just caution, you know, us to, like the PUC is doing and like Nevada is doing, is take a long, you know, thoughtful look at the ramifications of what we do before we make a, you know, a command decision to convert.
Absolutely. Do you want me to add nuclear to our energy generation our energy generation list?
That was quick. That was good, Devin. Okay, Ben.
That's on the secret list, Devin.
Okay. Yeah.
I was just going to say what Shelley mentioned prompted a thought, which was one thing that we might be able to incentivize that would help would be in-home battery storage, because that actually can help you in outages and smooth everything and fire and so many different things. So,
and I can't remember. John Edison, Sue, go ahead.
Just a quick backup, because that's exactly it's a backup energy source, because I think we're all trying to do generators now, and it's a lot of gas generators out there. So to incentivize the electric ones, that's, yeah, I was just going to
storage. Yes. Yeah. Was there someone else? I feel like somebody, John, was it?
I think, okay. I see Wes on the screen.
Okay. John and then Wes.
All right. Well, I would just say I'm planning to electrify our own house. Kick gas, as I say. But we'll see. I'll let you know how it goes. And
took me a minute there.
Yes,
John.
I said G. There's a G in the beginning of that. But so anyway, so I think there'd be a lot of projects coming forward. There's DOE has a cold climate heat pump challenge. Nice thing about electric heat pumps is they provide air conditioning too. So it's getting hotter. Most people don't have air conditioning. That's a benefit. But I'm guessing we're probably not going to be pursuing this short term as a basin-wide mandate. So that being said, we'll see how things unfold on the ground and continue to look at this as time goes by, as Haley suggested. So on the other ones, I'm intrigued by this excess square footage and energy use mitigation fee. It could have a side benefit of providing more. Maybe I guess, first of all, a question, what do you have in mind? Like what would be the base square footage and what would be excess before I make my commentary?
Yeah. If that is something that the board wishes to go, we'd want to do an analysis to understand what our average square footage for homes are here, what the minimum, what the maximum is.
Look what at they are or what they should be.
That's a good question. Jacob, you know, it varies. Jacob mentioned some examples where they have maximum square footage, Vail, Aspen. But, you know, on the flip side of that, Vail's maximum square footage is 24,000, and Vail's is 10,000. So is that really what fits? But if we were to pursue this, we would do more analysis on what our current built stock looks like, average energy uses for homes, and be able to calculate that. And it could be incentives. Like if you want to build a larger home, you could electrify your home. Therefore, you're not using as much carbon. So we would have to do an analysis to figure out what fits in Tahoe. I'd go out on a limb and say 24,000 square feet is probably more than we'd probably want to look at, but that is part of the analysis we would undertake.
It's not hard to imagine this has like affordable housing, built affordable by design, I think we call it, benefit. Mm-hmm. If all houses were built as 1,500 square feet houses rather than monster homes, we'd have a lot more affordable housing and people wouldn't have to leave the basin. We wouldn't have to cover as much new land for new projects because all the houses are too big to afford. So I like that one. And then on dark sky, the city of South Lake Tahoe actually have kind of started with municipal lighting, where we've pretty much moving toward a standard of all dark sky compliant lighting. We have sidewalk lighting going in along Highway 50. That's kind of a more 2200 Kelvin. It's not that bright, glary blue light LED, warmer light. You can check that out. I think that's about to be installed if it's not already. So I think this is an easy one. There's all kinds of data on the impact of non-dark sky lighting on wildlife and people for that matter. So I think that would be an easy one. Perhaps we can get some concurrence on.
Great. Thank you. Did anyone else have comments? Wes. Oh, I'm sorry, Wes. Thank you for the reminder.
I'm going to dig myself a hole here. I don't want to say you can pry my gas heater out of my cold, dead hands, but good gosh, folks, we don't have the infrastructure to electrify all of Lake Tahoe. If you will recall, the last time we had an emergency here, We had electric cars that were blocking the highway because they weren't charged before they could get going. And then they got stuck in the traffic with everybody trying to get out of here at the same time. And now the electric company, during certain hours of the day, are asking people not to charge their cars up or not to dry their clothes or not to turn their oven on. I'm sorry. We're not ready to go 100% electric. We are just not there, and I don't think we'll be there within 50 years. And so I'm showing my old age here. Anyway, that's my thought.
Thanks, Wes.
Let's move on to electric vehicles.
On that note.
Or zero emissions vehicles is what we're calling them for the
purpose. Why don't we go to hydrogen?
Is it zero emissions? So we can talk about hydrogen as well, or we can add it to the list. So this is another area where there's a lot of holes in our code that we could fix. We could incentivize EV chargers through a coverage exemption. That was something I mentioned earlier in the presentation. We could also just provide other guidelines to incentivize, but also facilitate appropriate construction of EV charging stations. We really don't have any standards for EV chargers right now in the code. So this could be an important one. This could include use guidelines for allowing them as an accessory use to different uses, signage requirements, parking requirements, snow removal. So this is one where we could really fill a gap in our code. We could also require EV charging or conduit for EV charging in new construction, similar to what we talked about with solar panels. So on the subject of electric watercraft, like Ms. Novosel brought up, that's another emerging trend that we need to keep on top of. So we could provide interpretations for how electric boat chargers would relate to our shoreline scenic standards. We can set standards for placement and performance of those chargers as well. There's currently nothing in our code for that. So any comments?
Sue? Yeah, thank you. Real quick. So El Dorado County has a dig once policy, whereas if someone's digging a hole, then you put a conduit in. So that would relate to both of those comments we were talking about as far as putting a conduit in. We try to use that as much as possible. It's a tough sell sometimes, but I think it makes sense to get that dig once policy going for all the different jurisdictions.
Shelley and then Ashley.
Requiring EV charging stations for new construction, we're talking about residential construction, commercial construction. For a small house to install an EV charging station, if they don't have an electric vehicle, seems to be a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, it could be either or both. California does have some requirements for the conduit to go in for new construction, and I believe their threshold is commercial businesses and then multifamily over 4 units. So I don't think they're currently required, unless something's changed because they're constantly changing the rules. I don't believe single family is required to do the conduit yet, but multifamily and commercial are. But again, it's just the conduit. So it's just okay. Yeah.
Well, and Devin, maybe we better clarify that because a conduit is different than a charging station. So.
I'm sorry, Ashley.
Yeah, I would just add, not to bring up a tough topic, but thinking about how to try to get co-location on cell towers, same thing with co-location of chargers, right? There's tons of different we need to have a much broader push to have universal charging for everything that we do, but at least having universal stations would be incredibly helpful. So thinking about co-location of charging types in one station, so you're not looking at a lot of different impervious surfaces for different charging types. You don't want to accidentally incentivize, sort of a hodgepodge of stations, but really coordinated development, putting them in the right places, and again, different types altogether.
Yes, I would advocate everyone write their congressperson to advocate for single port charging standards. Same for our cell phones.
Okay. Yes, John.
Another one. These are all great ideas. I wish I had more stickers. electric watercraft. I think we talked about that at a previous meeting. So I think that's the a solution to many problems and hopefully an emerging trend. And I think that makes a lot of sense to have guidelines, start thinking about guidelines and standards. And another one, expedited permitting for EV infrastructure. California has AB 1236 that requires an expedited permitting system for all jurisdictions. So that's going to be something I would encourage us to look at, for, you know, borrowing from, replicating.
Good. Vince.
I don't know what the local governments are doing about converting their own vehicle fleets, but I mean, that should be something that that we put in there. And then also thinking about non-vehicles, but all the small stuff that really emits a lot of CO2 and pollutants, you know, like gardening, lawnmowers and blowers and all those kind of things, snowblowers, anything, all that stuff can be electrified or made a lot cleaner than it is now. So coming up with better standards requirements for that.
Do I have other hands or comments? Okay.
Okay, on to the next one, sustainable construction and development. So this the topic of this balance between local regulation and regional regulation has been coming up a lot. And I think this is a topic area where we really need to be conscious of that. Some pieces are more appropriate for regulation by the local jurisdictions than by TRPA. Devin brought up the REACH code that the city of South Lake Tahoe is working on right now. And I think, you know, we could focus on updating our code to support local initiatives like that. So keeping this balance in mind, we have some ideas for how to update our code in this area. One could be requiring or incentivizing cool building materials. We could incentivize area-wide green infrastructure in town centers. So this could possibly be through a fee in lieu of coverage to support larger scale green infrastructure projects. Removing barriers to recycled construction materials. So an example of this is this could be as simple as a code interpretation affirming that certain recycled materials are appropriate for scenic findings for construction. Incentivizing solar ready or passive solar construction. So this could be done potentially by relaxing some dimensional requirements that would otherwise impede passive solar construction in some cases. One thing that came up with our permitting department is that we could have an opportunity to extend the grading and construction season in response to longer warm months. So that's something that we could do. And something that Shay, our stormwater expert, brought up is that we also have an opportunity to standardize our BMP guidelines for roof drip. This is roof runoff is relatively clean compared to roadway and driveway runoff. So we could standardize roof drip requirements in our code and really focus that energy more on the more polluting sources of runoff. And I'll open it up to you all for comments.
Comments? Questions?
Yes. What's cool with the materials?
They're just cool.
I have no
idea. Yeah, I mean, I think the cool. the most probably obvious example that pops to mind when we're talking about urban heat island effect and heat buildings is white roofs versus having a black roof because it reflects more. Obviously, that's more of a challenge with our scenic standards, painting a bunch of roofs white. Yeah. They now have the technology and the materials that these cool materials that are more reflective so they absorb less heat are available in a variety of colors that match with our current color guidelines. It could also be thicker insulation on your roof. The way the roof is designed, roof pitch comes up a lot in terms of we have this very steep roof pitches that have a lot of open space and air that's then heated and is an energy suck there. So there's a lot of material science that goes into creating materials that send more light back out into the atmosphere versus absorbing it.
And is there a difference between, say, Lake Tahoe's, although it's changing, our temperature guide compared to an average temperature, say in Sacramento, You know, should we be talking about this when we have cooler temperatures?
Yeah, absolutely. When you think extreme heat, you usually think the valley where it's up to 110. The extreme heat index, as defined in the science, especially through the California ADAPT tool, which has a lot of climate projections, they define Tahoe an extreme heat day, and Tahoe is 96 degrees. So that is something that, you know, at the right now we average two or three of those a year, you know, and in the future under climate scenarios, we're going to have 14 to 20 of those. And I think the big thing here is while that heat may not be as extreme as the valley, we don't have the infrastructure. Like not many people have AC in their homes. So it's a combination of heat, relatively hot to what we're used to, in combination with the lack of infrastructure such as air conditioning that causes those problems.
Yeah, thank you.
Other comments? Yes, Shelley.
Well, it goes back to John's comment. I mean, we're talking about capturing the heat. So we use cool roof materials. It reduces the heat inside the house, but are we missing an opportunity to capture that heat and store it? And, you know, for winter use?
That is a great question. Yeah, we want to reflect the heat in the summer and capture mm-hmm. the heat in the winter. And I'm sure someone smarter than me is trying to figure that out.
Oh, that's just the roof material flips yeah. over.
That's right. I'm not seeing other comments. I just
one quick question. I'm okay. sorry. When I visited Tesla with our group, they had the roof, the solar roof was incorporated inside. Where do you know the technology on that? And can we incentivize that?
Their terracotta tiles.
Yeah, their terracotta the shingles. Tiles.
Yeah, that is one of the items that our current planning department is starting to see more of. And okay. they do have some of those same concerns with the reflectivity and scenic issues. So we're working through those, but we are starting to see more requests for that technology coming through.
Okay. All right, thank you.
I was just going to suggest that I've also seen in public projects now, some of the communities have been using different surfacing for their coating on their streets and bike trails to do the same thing and reflect the energy. So I don't know if that's something that we could look at as well and how effective those have been. They've been measuring some on reducing heat in urban cores. Yes, Shelley?
Just one more thing. The two final bullets, extend grading season based on new climate science, does that really fit under sustainable construction development? I think it's a great idea, but I'm just wondering, I'm running out of dots in this particular category, and then standardizing the roof drip line BNP design guidelines. I think they're both good ideas, but I don't know they belong under this category, in this category. That would be my only observation.
No, good comment. I think they just got put there because they didn't fit perfectly in any of the categories. Yeah. And I know we did give you limited dots on purpose to try to force some prioritization, but just because ideas up here don't get dots doesn't mean we're not going to continue looking at them and engaging stakeholders on them. I think the discussion has pointed out a lot of areas where there's a lot of differing opinions, and we'll take those ones more serious. But I think if things necessarily didn't get a lot of votes, but they also got a lot of positive comments throughout this discussion, we'll take that into consideration as well.
And Madam Chair, if I may, just really quick, this might be a silly level set, but just to level set, even with all these great ideas, what we're doing is talking about removing barriers in the code, right? Individual projects still come back before the board. So it's not like our end all be all of weighing in on this either, right? Of course, we want to have some idea where we're headed, but this isn't it.
Yeah, they may not all come back to the board for approval, but they would go through our planning process where all of the checks and balances that are currently in place would still be in place.
Thank you. And that is much more eloquent. It will still come back to TRPA. We are not the end of all of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not seeing others.
Continue. Yeah. And I don't know. The next topic is short. We could skip it or we could... Or we could go at it. What do you think, Devin?
Just thinking about time, I feel like you have limited number of dots. And for the ones that we've already discussed on carbon sequestration, forestry and vegetation, we have removing barriers to community gardens and parks and residential lots, forest treatment and riparian zones, and then removing barriers to green roofs. But I think we can move that green roofs over to sustainable construction and development. So for sake of time, I know we have to be wrapped up by 4 and we still have two more items after this. I'd suggest that we move that last one aside and have you all vote now on the 5 remaining boards if you want to get up and do your dots.
Can I just ask you a quick question? So
because I was out for this. So the green infrastructure, is that inclusive of bioswales and other? Okay, great. Thanks.
Cool. Do you think you're still going to have the time for public safety?
Yeah, probably. I can double time it.
Sure.
Some good options. I want to vote for all of them.
Well, you know,
is there an option just do the whole thing?
Just because you didn't vote for something like Devin said doesn't mean we're not going to do it.
Right. That's true. This is not the last chance.
This is all stuff that we're considering, and it's going to come back to you guys too.
All right, I'm going to institute some Jeopardy music to get people voting. Dun 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 dun. Da da na 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 na. All right. As the final dots are put up, it looks like we did have a wide variety. There's a lot of dots in construction, sustainable construction for area-wide green infrastructure. It looks like over in carbon, there's a lot for vegetation management in riparian zones, removing barriers for energy efficiency and solar generation, other types of generation got a lot of votes. Biomass particularly got quite a few. Dark sky lighting, energy efficiency got a lot of votes. EV infrastructure has votes. Snow clearing has votes. While that wraps up, maybe Madam Chair, I'd suggest we go to public comment and then we can wrap up our item.
Okay. Do we have members of the public that would like to address the governing board? If so, you can raise your hand if you're here in person, and I'm not seeing any here. Otherwise, raise your hand on the Zoom link, and we will call on you to speak.
Madam Chair, we have one hand raised.
Okay.
Molly Armenino, if you unmute, you can address the board.
I just joined on super late to this meeting, and I was kind of briefly just looking at the PowerPoint presentation, so I apologize if this has kind of already been discussed, but I was wondering, it looks like the TRPA greenhouse gas reduction targets are net zero by 2045, and I just wanted confirmation that that's not the 2030 goal in alignment with the city's renewable goal. And I was just kind of wondering what the difference, why there's a difference between net zero by 2045 versus the city's climate goal by 2030. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other public comments? Devin, I might ask you to address that issue.
Yep, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Friedrich, the city's goal for 100% renewable energy by 2030, 24/7 is purely the electricity goal. The overall TRPA goal of net zero by 2045 is all carbon emissions. So that's including transportation, gas, waste, wastewater. So I think we're definitely in alignment with all the local jurisdictions in the various goals and subsets of greenhouse gas emissions.
Great. Thank you. And thank you for the comment. Okay. With that, we can close the public comment. Are there any further comments, board members? Okay, that was the most participatory we've been, and I want to thank staff for the incredible.
Yeah, well, we were inspired by the housing group and wanted, again, to bring this here early because I think this was a very fruitful discussion. We've obviously heard a lot. We're going to work with our stakeholders as we move forward with this process with the identified priorities here today and all other things Climate Resilience Initiative. So thank you very much for having us.
Great. Thank you, Devin and Jake. We really appreciate it. Well done. Okay, so that brings us to agenda item 7B, briefing on the Lake Tahoe Shoreline Public Safety Facilities Planning Process. Information on this item can be found on page 243 of your packets. And as a reminder, again, after staff presentation and board discussion, you may raise your hand in person to be called on in Zoom. or to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So Jacob, would you like to continue on with the entertainment this afternoon?
Yes, I promise. Act two of this afternoon's entertainment. So again, for the record, my name is Jacob Stock. I'm a senior planner with TRPA in the Long Range Division. I'm here to give an informational presentation on the Lake Tahoe Shoreline Public Safety Facilities planning process. A little bit of a mouthful, and as with anything with Shoreline. We also have an upcoming action strategy document. So I'm going to give you a little presentation on that process and the document to come. I'll share the plan's background and findings and leave it open for comments and questions at the end. So I'll do my best. It's been a long day. I'll do my best to keep this brief. Hopefully we have some of the participants from our working group on the line to also share their comments and experiences. Next slide, please. So this planning process looked at locations for dedicated public safety facilities serving first responders on Lake Tahoe itself. So this was a collaborative effort involving TRPA staff and partners from around the basin. The planning process and results were defined by a working group of first responders operating around the lake, and you can see a list of those partners up here on this slide. So this included representatives from sheriff's offices and fire protection districts, as well as state agencies and the Forest Service. Once potential locations for facilities were identified, we also started to bring in representatives of the landowners that would be involved in developing these facilities. And I really want to thank everyone who participated in this process. This was a big effort, and it occurred during fire season when a lot of these folks are really busy. And so not only were they great partners in this planning process, they're also great public servants who keep us safe every day. And I really want to thank them for that. And so next slide, please. So why a planning process for public safety facilities on the shoreline, you might ask yourself, or me. This plan is part of TRPA's effort to proactively implement the 2018 Shoreline Plan and Climate Resilience Programming that you've been hearing so much about today. The plan identifies the need for regionally distributed, dedicated, and adapted facilities for public safety agencies to respond to emergencies on Lake Tahoe. And as a result of the shoreline planning process, the code also allows for some exceptions from design requirements for public safety piers and other shoreline safety facilities. So at this point, we're ready to take the next step and start thinking about implementing these elements of the shoreline plan and the code. And it's important to note that we're not getting into permitting here in this plan and this planning process, but instead we're working with our partners to agree on a broad and proactive regional level plan for facilities looking into the future. And there's a clear need for these facilities too. First responders are currently mooring their vessels at rented or leased piers that aren't designed to accommodate these types of vessels. This can impact response times and make safety vessels vulnerable to damage in many cases. And there are clear examples of that as well that I'll get to. Sheriff's offices reached out to TRPA leadership about these issues prior to the planning process. So that's one of the impetus of this process. Finally, this planning process plugs right into these climate resilience efforts that we've been talking about today. And so you've been hearing a lot about climate resilience, and we're now looking at ways to really implement this program. We're increasingly vulnerable to extreme weather events, including storms and drought, and of course, wildfire. This increased risk increases risk for those enjoying the lake and also for the first responders tasked with their safety when they come to visit and recreate here. One of the things that the working group really focused on was making sure that public safety vessels could access water quickly during drought conditions. So in particular, we focused on ensuring access to water at elevation 6219, which is considered navigable depth during drought conditions on the lake. Next slide, please.
So this plan focuses on ensuring that first responders can continue to respond to emergencies on Lake Tahoe by identifying ideal locations and needs for safety facilities. To achieve this, the working group came up with criteria for analyzing potential sites, identified potential locations and needs for facilities, and also looked at considerations for facility development, including regulations and partnerships that would be required. Next slide. Okay, so this map shows where agencies currently moor public safety facilities on the lake, and I recognize that it's maybe a little hard to see here. Those online can probably see it fine. So as I mentioned, aside from the Coast Guard's facility in Tahoe City, these moorings are not formally designed for public safety. A lot of these are rented or leased piers or moorings around the lake. And this can slow mobilization in an emergency and low water conditions. And it can, again, also make vessels vulnerable to damage during storms. Next slide. Oh, here we go. Okay, so a couple of examples. So South Lake Tahoe and El Dorado County agencies, along with actually the Douglas County Sheriff's Department, currently operate out of Tahoe Keys Marina. So this concentration of vessels at Tahoe Keys means that agencies are not really distributed across the South Shore to respond to emergencies. And this is, you know, as we all know, a very high traffic area where there are a lot of emergency calls. And navigation through the Keys can also slow response times. It takes a while for the fire department, for example, to get from the parking lot to their vessel to navigate through the marina, exit the marina to respond to a call. And then another example is Douglas County. The Tahoe Douglas Fire Protection District currently moors at Zephyr Cove Pier. The fire district's Marine 2 boat, as some of you may be aware, was severely damaged in a storm this winter. And because it was moored at a pier that was not designed to accommodate that type of vessel under those types of conditions. So given these issues, it became clear that first responders need dedicated and planned facilities on the lake to keep their vessels and to respond to emergencies. Next slide. So the working group held a kickoff meeting in early March 2022 to define the goals and objectives of this process. A workshop meeting in late March identified potential locations and criteria for evaluating locations. And TRPA went back and analyzed these potential locations using a set of criteria, which I'll go over in the next slide. And in April and May, we met in small groups based on the agencies that would share facilities. These are ideally going to be shared facilities. And we use these meetings to choose ideal, or we called them preferred locations, for facilities on the lake. A second workshop with the combined group discussed the needs of each facility and recommendations that would go into the plan. TRPA staff and the working group collaborated on developing the plan language, and we are still in draft form there. We shared this presentation to APC in September, and we're continuing to work with some of our partners on the meat and potatoes of identifying preferred locations. And so we'll get more into that as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so now let's get into the results of the planning process. And I hope this is a little more clear. It's still kind of hard to see the map, but the preferred locations, like I said, are sites that the working group identified as ideal locations for public safety facilities on the lake. Finding preferred locations was both an art and a science for the working group. The evaluation criteria that we came up with, I would consider to be the science part. The group looked at the following location criteria to evaluate preferred locations. So we have site availability, the ownership of the site, environmental and scenic sensitivity, response times to key locations on the lake where we get a lot of emergency calls, protection during storm conditions, existing infrastructure, land access, so the ability of land-based emergency vehicles to access the lake-based facility and access to navigable water, as I mentioned before, particularly that elevation 6219 for drought condition access. So that's the science part. Probably more important was the art part. And the art part is really the special knowledge and relationships that the working group brought to the table. These folks really know Tahoe's shoreline and they know how to do their job. And so we combined this art and the science, and our discussion led to the preferred locations that I'm going to talk about in the following slides. Before we get there, though, it's important to note that you'll see on the slide that the preferred location for Washoe County is still to be determined. We're continuing to work with first responders in Washoe County on identifying potential site and meeting with site owners. And we plan to come back to you hopefully soon with a preferred location for Washoe County. Next slide. But for now, let's talk about the city of South Lake Tahoe. So response on the lake is highly collaborative, but in the city along the shoreline, the South Lake Tahoe Fire Rescue and Police Departments are the primary agencies tasked with public safety along the shoreline there. So they would collaborate around use of a shared facility. They chose Ski Run Marina as their preferred location. The marina is located near the center of town at the end of Ski Run Boulevard, for those who aren't familiar with it. On the South Shore, access to deep water is really a big issue. There's a shallow shelf that runs across much of the South Shore, and so this made it really challenging to find locations on the South Shore for our first responders. This is a great site because there's existing maintenance dredging that maintains a deep channel. It makes it a really preferable site for accessing deep water. You can actually kind of see the dark place here on this aerial image where there's been maintenance dredging to allow access. So a safety facility at Ski Run Marina would likely require a new pier, but it could be a shorter pier because of the maintenance dredging that already exists on site. And we were able to contact the marina owner and bring him in for some talks early in the process, and he's really supportive and open to continuing talks. So the city is continuing to look into this site. Next slide, please. So the sites on El Dorado County were really limited, again, because of this shallow shelf. So the El Dorado County Sheriff's Department and Lake Valley Fire Protection District landed on Camp Richardson as their preferred location. I think everyone here is probably familiar with this site. It's a very popular recreation site. And there are a number of features that make Camp Richardson a great location for first responders. First of all, it is close to the areas of the highest volume of emergency calls. So that being Emerald Bay and actually Camp Richardson itself. So it's really ideal for response in that area. There's also an existing pier at this location, which already extends into water that is navigable for these public safety vessels. We included Bob Hassett, the owner of Camp Richardson, in one of our meetings, and he supports a continued discussion of this location as a potential site. Next slide. Okay, so looking at Placer County, Placer County Sheriff's Department, North Tahoe Fire Protection District, and California State Parks chose Tahoe State Recreation Area as their preferred site. This is an existing pier owned by State Parks. It's that long, straight one there next to the L-shaped one, second from the bottom. This is located near the CVS in Tahoe City, not far upshore from the Tahoe City Marina, if you guys are familiar with that area. It's an existing publicly owned pier that currently accesses navigable water, which makes it a great location. It's owned by one of the partners here, in this case, California State Parks, which is even better. However, the pier will require some renovations in order to make it usable, along with some modifications onshore on the parcel to allow for emergency vehicle access. Next slide. So Douglas County is a little farther along in their planning process. They've been meeting independently as a group to plan an addition to the Zephyr Cove Pier for public agencies. They're already moored at Zephyr Cove Pier, at least Tahoe Douglas Fire Protection District is. Oh, that says Placer.
It's Washoe, but it's...
Oh, that's Douglas. Actually, Douglas. It's Douglas. It says Placer, so that's a typo on the slide. My apologies, you guys. It should say Douglas. This is Zephyr Cove Pier in Douglas County. And this facility would include the Tahoe Douglas Fire Protection District, Douglas County Sheriff, Nevada Department of Wildlife, and Douglas County Search and Rescue. So it would be serving several agencies, and they've been working through their own process to plan this facility. But keeping the rest of the group involved and also helping other jurisdictions along the way. So they've been a partner in this process as well, but forging ahead with this site at Zephyr Cove Pier. And they plan to have a facility completed by spring 2024. So that's really exciting to get one of these on the ground relatively soon. So again, you'll notice there's no slide for Washoe County yet. We're still... identifying a preferred location for Washoe County, and you can see attachment B in your packet, which summarizes some of the locations that we've considered thus far. And we'll get back to you on that one once we have more information. Next slide, please. So next steps and implementation. Every group is in a slightly different place, but broadly speaking, after identifying preferred locations, agencies are ready to formalize partnerships around a shared facility and seek initial funding for planning and design. So at this point, we're handing the implementation off to the agencies who will be sharing these facilities and developing these facilities. After securing funding and design, they should start permit submittal. You can see attachment C in your packet, which outlines the permitting process for TRPA. But there are several other agencies involved in permitting on the shoreline, as I'm sure you're aware. So TRPA will staff, myself and Tiffany Good and other staff will remain available to help these agencies as they move forward with this process. And additionally, we'll continue to work with Washoe County to identify and pursue their preferred safety location. Next slide. Okay, yeah, and that's it. So I'll conclude my presentation and just add that Mason Bindle and I put together a story map for this project. And I think it's a really great way to visualize the work that we've been doing. So I encourage you to take a look at that. That's attachment A in your packet. And I'll open it up to questions and comments from here.
Thank you so much, Jacob. Great presentation. Comments, questions from board members?
Sue? Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. And thank you for taking care of this. This is incredibly important to all of our jurisdictions, all of our local jurisdictions, hear the concerns about, especially after Caldor, realizing that we need fire safety in and around our lakes also. So it's incredibly important. I just had a quick question. During the process, it's always funding with our local jurisdictions on how we get there. Is there any, do you know of, or are you talking about trying to help with the process of getting these permits through a little quicker so that we could perhaps save a little money? And is there any federal funding out there that you can see on the horizon for us to be able to put in to help us put in some of these? Because this is going to be quite a bit of money, I would imagine. So is there any help out there you see on the horizon to help us?
We have discussed potentially including these projects in the environmental improvement program, which would help with permitting, the permitting portion of it. We've also been keeping our eyes out for grants. The state of California has the adaptation planning grant, which applications are coming up in 2 months, I believe, for that, which, we believe this could be that pot of money could be applicable for these facilities in California potentially. So we're working again at this phase, we're handing it off to the agencies, but we're still working with them and advising them on where to go.
Thank you. Any help would be greatly appreciated.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions, board members? I had two. One is we had talked quite a bit. There was a fair amount of discussion in Meeks Bay about a potential pier. And when I look at the West Shore, it's a pretty long distance between the two, the Tahoe City and the El Dorado site. Was there any further discussion? Just so I'm aware when people ask me about it. Yes.
So that's a great question. The representatives from North Tahoe,
Don't confuse the two.
I know. For those who don't know, the two fire protection districts on the North Shore are North Tahoe and North Lake Tahoe. So don't get them confused. But for North Tahoe, the folks that we were working with there, who's the fire marshal, Brent Armstrong.
Yes.
Really liked the Tahoe City facility, and that was for a number of reasons, really the main one being the central location in their district.
I'm good with it. I just didn't want to get asked about why I wasn't doing something at Homewood or Obexer's or somewhere else. Yeah, or Meeks Bay.
Absolutely.
That one we already knew. The second part of that question, though, is I'm really familiar with that site. In my previous career, I built that bike trail that has to wind down to that site. So when you say a little bit of issue to get vehicles there for emergency response, it would seem to me a pretty big lift to get emergency vehicles down to that pier. Am I
I may have understated the lift
for getting emergency vehicles. Just wanted to make sure. I'm not sure if this is the existing pier at the campground. Is that correct?
Yes,
not
that's
at correct. State Parks also owns another pier just down that little side street, Frontage Road. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of that, right on the other side of Lake Terrace Street. Anyway, but that one in particular is right next to the bike trail. The bike trail can be used, but it is not a quick access for emergency vehicles and certainly not multiple emergency vehicles. I mean, it is a 12-foot wide trail, but it winds, as you know, down that hillside for ADA accessibility. So,
yeah, that was that.
Agree if they think they can do it, that's great. I do agree with the central location, absolutely. And that's where I was getting frustrated with the Meeks Bay request and others, is not having this plan. So I really commend having the plan so we can focus our energy. And if they've bought in on that, I'm really happy about it. So thank you for your facilitation of that. Any other comments or questions from board members? If not, we'll go to the public on this item, public comment on this item. If you have any, would like to address the board on this issue, you can raise your hand here in public or on Zoom, and we will call on you for your comments.
Madam Chair, we have the North Tahoe Fire Protection District, Brent Armstrong.
Hey, Brent.
Brent, you are unmuted. You can address the board.
Thank you all. Brent Armstrong, North Tahoe Fire Protection District, and Meeks Bay Fire Protection District. So I guess starting off, just really wanted to commend the staff for really putting all this together. The collaboration between all parties was just spot on, and really putting together a great think tank to really look at all aspects of the public safety piers and all the components that come with it. So kind of addressing a few questions that came up. You know, we really wanted to have something on West Shore, but what was difficult down there is finding a location that's protected from weather, and then having the staffing that's available to adequately respond a piece of equipment out of there. So we really partnered with Placer County Sheriff's Office and the U.S. Coast Guard and State Parks to try to figure out, like, really what would be achievable in the event of a response. And ultimately, being our staffing being majority in Tahoe City and being somewhat centrally located, at least through the North Shore and West Shore there on that western region, that we can have a strong response collectively through all partners at that Tahoe City location. So yes, we would love to have something along the West Shore, but ultimately it came down to not having a good weather break, accessibility always being a difficult because a lot of private land ownership down the West Shore, and just not being a feasible location. And then the second one is the elevation gain is pretty steep. Getting an ambulance down to shoreline to offload or get crews onto a vessel in the Tahoe City was a concern. But kind of thinking it through with the bike path that's there, there would be a restructure that would make it to be vehicle access only for first responders, that they could drive on that portion of a path, a footpath, where they could park apparatus at the bottom, get onto a vessel, and then come back offload either there at that location or to a waiting ambulance at a nearby, you know, offloading facility. So if the patient was in West Shore, we wouldn't necessarily come all the way back to Tahoe City. We would go to the nearest location where we can get that patient offloaded onto a staged ambulance or aircraft where we would fly into a trauma center. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I really commend Jacob and staff for all the work they put in this. They really approached it with an open lens, so greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Brent. That was great feedback. I appreciate it. Any other public comment on this item?
Madam Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll close public comment. Are there any other comments from the board? If not, we can move on. This was an informational item. I think I'd echo the kudos for bringing the group together and really working on this important issue.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now on to agenda item 8, reports. And John, I'm going to go to you first on this.
All right. Want to point out in your monthly report that we've added the 3120 on permits. Shelley, we're expecting you to give us some input on format, so you can do it offline if you want. Also wanted to point out, ask the board members to put on your calendar for December 14th, after the governing board meeting, we would like to have a little reception. I understand some of you are retiring off the board, or Yay. Some of you online might be termed out, whatever it is. So want to do that, and then remind everybody to be here at 5:30 tonight and 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, so I can end my term as interim as soon as possible. Thank you,
John. Appreciate it. Mr. Marshall, you were going to do a presentation, but I hear we're going to bring that back at another date.
Well, I knew I wasn't going to be able to do it when Jacob said the only thing left was entertainment. So this is boring stuff. No, it's not. It's exciting. It's thrilling. Yes, we're going to continue the open meeting law lecture to a future date when you're bright and bushy-tailed. But the one thing I do want to remind you is that for tonight, it's not a public meeting. So it's a social event. And that means, though, that there are no you can't deliberate with each other. You can't, you know, it's just purely social. So have a great time and enjoy yourselves. As for legal matters, I wanted to update you on three things. Something?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Last week, we had the oral argument in the Ninth Circuit on the Garmong versus TRPA case. I know a couple of you watched it. Our outside counsel, Deb, did a great job. The panel gave the attorney for Garmong a pretty hard time on how they had drafted their complaint and the number of causes of action and the failure to allege the critical cause of action, which was the judicial review of the agency's decision to issue the permit for the cell tower. Now, reading tea leaves, it seems like, you know, we're in pretty good shape to get the case dismissed. I think worst case, they would give leave to amend to just assert a judicial review claim on that decision. We've already filed the record in the case, and then we would just brief whether or not the board made a rational decision when it granted the permit for that cell tower. I don't know if Shelley or Bill would like to add anything.
My only comment to John this morning was, you know, I felt sorry for the appellant's counsel because he was defending a brief that he didn't prepare. So that put him in a kind of an awkward awkward position. But I agree with Don. I think for all intents and purposes, it seemed to go well. And, you know, the judges were very inquisitive, asked a lot of questions. And so I'm hopeful.
Okay. Was that a recognize me cough, or it was just a, number two, we have been sued again. I think maybe you have seen the complaint, but the Dobbinses, who, if you remember, applied for a buoy off their property in Glenbrook, they have sued TRPA and Glenbrook Homeowners Association, or GHOA. They have sued us over the determination to deny their buoy application, and they sued GHOA over ownership to that lot that sits in front of their property. So that's a quiet title action. They filed the case just a week and a half ago or so in state court in Douglas County. Usually in these cases, we will remove the case to the District of Nevada. That way, there's one appellate court that sits above California and Nevada, the Ninth Circuit, and you get, you know, uniformity in of opinions. If we keep everything in federal court, we can remove because our compact is federal law, and so we have federal question jurisdiction over the TRPA causes of action. And pendant jurisdiction over the state law causes of action. And Jessica can lecture further on pendant jurisdiction if you'd like to do that. lastly, unless there's any other questions.
Not that I want, you know, it's always good to bring as many people to the party as possible. I was wondering why the state of Nevada wasn't also named as a defendant, since they declined to issue a permit for his buoy as well.
They were not.
I know they were not. because he was pitting himself against the state of Nevada, I guess. Maybe he thought we were easier prey. I don't know. I just think that was interesting that they specifically excluded the state. Maybe it's just because, that's right. He's so mean-spirited. That's right.
So just one more thing, since it's this is a lawsuit by a disappointed applicant, so our usual indemnification special condition is not triggered here, so we will be handling this case in-house with guidance from Debbie on any litigation strategy questions that we feel is appropriate. Lastly, in the Horosh versus TRPA case, if you remember, this is where there's two neighbors fighting over a pier permit. The Johannessons received the pier permit, and the Horosh parties were opposed because it was adjacent to their property. The Horosh sued TRPA over the issuance of the permit. That was about a year ago. We filed a partial motion to dismiss, including claim one, which I'll describe in just a second. And that has been sitting with the federal court in the Eastern District of California for quite some time. The Johannessons finally got their, if you remember, they didn't have yet their permit from Army Corps. They got their Army Corps permit. They acknowledged our permit, And 2 days ago, they commenced construction on their pier, basically driving piles because, as you may or may not know, the season for constructing piers is the opposite of the season for grading because of fish habitat and fish concerns. The Harash parties went in and sought a temporary restraining order that same day, yesterday, I think it was. Later that day, the court issued their TRO, which requires the Johannessens to stop construction. We didn't really have a big dog in the fight because whether it's, you know, whether they build the pier or not, it's, you know, I don't know. I guess we have some interest in the integrity of our permits. It's now set for a hearing on a preliminary injunction for the remainder of the lawsuit the hearing will be November 8th. What is interesting about this is the court in its temporary restraining order found that Harash was likely to succeed on claim one of their complaint against TRPA. And as you may know for issuing temporary restraining orders or a preliminary injunction, you gauge the strength of the claim versus the potential injury. You sprinkle in considerations of public interest, and the judge makes a decision on whether or not to enjoin the activity that is being contested. The judge stopped the pier construction based both on injury and likelihood to succeed on the merits of claim one. Claim one is that TRPA processes violate the compact in two ways. One, if you remember, like earlier today, on an appeal, if there is an appeal of a grant of a permit, it's like the action is coming to you to revoke the permit. Okay, not the permit's already been issued by the hearings officer as a result of delegation to the hearings officer or delegating to staff. So, when it gets to you, there is an inverse situation where to revoke a permit, you need 5 votes in favor of the appeal. Okay. Instead of if it came directly to you, like a project would come directly to you, the project would need to get the permit 5 affirmative votes. So the Harash parties alleged that our processes violate the compact, which requires that projects get a 5-9 vote, a supermajority vote from the state that the project is located. And if you recall, the vote on the appeal was 4 votes voting no on the appeal, right? And 1 vote abstaining. So that although there was no votes in favor of granting the appeal, there wasn't 5 votes in favor of the project. So in that situation, the question is that consistent with the compact? What that the underlying issue is whether or not we can delegate projects to either the hearings officer or the executive director because a permit will be issued without a 5-9 vote, right? Or is it just the fact that there was an appeal and it came to the board and the board did not have 5 affirmative votes for the project, and therefore that violated the compact, which requires a 5-9 vote. It's a bit conflated or, you know, technical here. So we don't know exactly what the court was saying. It was just one line in the court's order. It's a TRO, but it appears to us that the court has done some work on the motion to dismiss. Remember that we filed a while ago, and is probably a good indication of the court's anticipated result on our motion to dismiss, which would be to deny our legal grounds, which basically said you can't state a claim because both these are legally appropriate ways of dealing with our workload. Both the delegation and treating an appeal is as a revocation instead of a permit issuance in the first place. So hopefully during the preliminary injunction stage, we'll get a little more feedback from the court on what she meant in this particular one sentence that we can't really parse based on just what it said. But it's a very important ruling. It only affects right now this particular project. So we're not planning on changing anything. But oftentimes in these situations, you want to try to figure out how to lose the best if you're going to lose. And so from our position, it's better to lose on the appeal rule than the delegation. So if that's what's really concerned the court, we want to make sure that is restricted and she understands the relative importance of the issue to us. So that'll be our interest in this next round of briefing on the preliminary injunction. And that's it. So thank you. Or if you have any questions, excuse me.
Isn't it customary, for a conservative judge, and I don't mean that politically, I just mean somebody who doesn't want to inflict harm on any of the parties, to issue a temporary restraining order if there's any vacuity, and whether or not she did an exhaustive analysis of that, of the item of the issue that's being disputed, is unknown. Is that she may just be waiting for us to brief so that she has a better and more thorough understanding of how our processes work.
I would say generally, yes, that there is a tendency to maintain the status quo, which in this case was no peer. Because then if you don't join the activity and it turns out later that it was improperly granted, the structure is there. So generally, I personally would not have commenced construction, but that's not my choice. But here, we've already briefed the issue, the legality of TRPA's delegation and the revocation position on our motion to dismiss. That's what gives us more pause than just usually, it's a balancing. So you could have a lower degree of success on the merits if you're relative harm is higher. And we're a little concerned that the judge was pretty up to snuff on what the legal issues were on the claim one. So that's why it's important to us to go in and try to parse out what the court really meant. That's going to be in Sacramento on the 8th.
Is it being broadcast?
Yes. You might turn on your mic when you want to respond like that so we can get it on tape. Yes, it should be broadcast. When we have one, we will send it to you.
Any other comments or questions on General Counsel's report?
Now we'll just, everything comes to you. Everything.
Okay, then we'll move on to governing board member reports. Agenda item 9, are there any governing board member reports? I don't see Wes or Barbara still online, so I think I'm not seeing any here. Then we'd move on to committee reports. Anything from local government and housing, legal, operations and governance? Okay. Doesn't sound like we have any other committee reports. Then we'll go to our final general public interest comment period. Any member of the public wishing to address the governing board on any item listed or not listed on the agenda, including items on the consent calendar, may do so at this time. Individuals or groups who have already commented on items listed on the agenda are not permitted to comment on that same topic, and the governing board is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public during this public comment period. Are there any members of the public who wish to address the board?
Madam Chair, there are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Let's make sure, because I didn't read that. If anybody's on from the public and you'd like to address us, please raise your hand on Zoom or star 9. Okay.
Madam Chair, there are still no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay, thank you for giving it one more shot because I hadn't read the full thing. So after that, is there a motion to recess? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries, and we are recessed at 4:15 p.m. Thank you all.